Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead, make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, going to be talking about the budget, some of the higher education cuts, what's that going to mean to our future. Also in the first hour, Dan Kane, Secretary Treasurer of the United Mine Workers of America, going to talk about their history and the fact that today is a momentous day in their history. The Mine Health and Safety Bill passed today back in 1970, protecting miners. So that'll be interesting to talk to him about. In the second hour, Joan Wages from the National Women's History Museum group is going to be here talking about why is there no museum to women? I thought there had been. I didn't know there wasn't. So we'll find out why. Also, Ian Murphy, he's running for Congress in the 26th District of New York from the guy. You remember the guy who, you know, had his taking pictures in the hotel mirror with his shirt off, you know, like he was some buff guy trying to pick up a little something on the side while his wife was back home in New York. Well, he's running in that race. May 24th is the date of that special election. And in the third hour, Adrian Grimes, singer-songwriter, wrote a great song for Madison, Wisconsin, and the whole movement going on there. So we thought we'd get him on, play his song, and talk a little bit about what it means and you know, being from Britain, what he sees the differences between the two countries. So that ought to be interesting. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The big story today that I came across, and there's a bunch of them, there's a bunch of stuff we're going to get to, the energy talk, the budget, you know, a bunch of stuff. But there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal written by a guy named Andrew Ackerman that grabbed my attention. It's titled TARP Watchdog Spars Over Too Big to Fail. And he writes, in the final days on the job, the federal bailout watchdog squabbled publicly with a Treasury official over the legacy of the $700 billion troubled asset relief program, the TARP money, as both individuals testified before lawmakers. Speaking before a House Oversight and Government Relations Subcommittee, this guy Neil Barofsky, he's leaving, I guess. He's leaving the agency, the group there, the Special Inspector General's Office for TARP. He warned that the same too big to fail firms that nearly brought this country to its knees and nearly destroyed our economy in 2008 have become even bigger, and now they're even more interconnected and continue to maintain this really unfair advantage over small competitors. And we've talked about this from the beginning. When this happened in 2008, the first thing I said should happen, we should break up these big banks. We should be holding them responsible because they're the ones who did this. We didn't. We basically said, here's a whole boatload of money. Please prop up our economy. Don't make it worse. He goes on to write, the federal bailout also fell far short of helping Main Street by encouraging greater bank lending. Did that happen? Did we see greater bank lending? No. Did we see any assistance to homeowners who had troubled mortgages who needed a hand? Not really. He goes on to say a TARP-funded mortgage modification program was a colossal failure. The House, of course, voted on Tuesday to end that program. Borofsky said TARP's most significant legacy may be the fact that it has exacerbated the problems. It's made the problems much worse, and it's kind of enforced this too big to fail this mantra here. Particularly, he says, given the manner in which the Treasury Department executed the bailouts. He says largely sparing executives, sparing shareholders, creditors, and counterparts. Those folks were fine. It's the people at the bottom who hurt. What he says it did, it reinforced that the government would not only bail them out, but help them in the long run, and the executives and the shareholders and all those people, they'd be fine. He also said that it has done very little to help the people at the bottom. The people who caused this mess, they did fine. And this is what I've been saying from the start. Whatever happened to risk? You know, we were always told that, well, you know, the investor class, you know, they need these tax breaks. The investor class needs this boost. They need this because, you know, risk, there's a risk in investing in companies and a risk in giving mortgages. That's why they need this massive reward. But look, you know, this, they took massive risks because they knew we're going to bail them out. So let me ask you, if you're going to Vegas, you're going to Atlantic City, you're going over here to the casino down the road, and you don't have any fear that you're going to lose the house, you don't have any fear that your kid's not going to get G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip for Christmas because you lost all the money, you've got no fear. You're fearless. You're insured. Someone has got your back, the American taxpayer. How many times are you going to pull that lever? How much risk are you going to take? Are you going to put all your money on Black 21? Of course you would, because you're not the one losing. And that's what we've created for a very small number of people. Those at the very, very top, we've created this environment where we say, here, take everything, please create jobs, and if you fail, we will help you. Now understand, this TARP thing, as much as the Republicans want to blame this on Obama, this was Bush's baby. But the Republicans seem to forget that, and they want to blame Obama. And trust me, I got enough problems with Obama. I got enough complaints there. But look at what it did. And look at what it was supposed to do. For me, this whole collapse, this was a bank heist. And as the Wall Street Journal points out, the $700 billion TARP money, according to the Congressional Budget Office, probably only going to cost us, the taxpayers, about $19 billion. They're actually saying that we'll probably get it all back over a little bit of time. But how much did you and I lose? How much did we get ripped off? How much did people who have 401ks get ripped off? How much did retirees get ripped off? That's what this was about. This was about stealing wealth from the working class. There's a big pot of money out there, which is why they want to get a hold of Social Security so badly. They want to tie Social Security up in this too-big-to-fail situation so that they can take it. Anyway, Mr. Borofsky cautioned that overall estimates distract from TARP's considerable non-financial costs. And what does he mean by that? Well, he means that we've created this environment where the consolidated banks, they have no fear. And they're going to continue to lay those big bets. Turning to last year's Dodd-Frank law, Borofsky said the financial regulatory overhaul has clearly failed to damp market expectations that the government will bail out systematically important firms, basically saying, look, too big to fail. So what we've gotten bigger banks. Smaller number of them, but much bigger, controlling much more wealth, and really holding us hostage in the end. Now, Republicans, they see an opportunity to go after and bash Obama. This representative from North Carolina, Republican Patrick McHenry, He's the chairman of the subcommittee there. He said that the Dodd-Frank bill reinforced the bailout culture, perpetuated the moral hazard of government intervention. Yet these are the people that he takes money from. And I just find it really interesting. I find it really interesting when we're willing to bail out those who don't need it. We're willing to take homes from families because banks wrote bad mortgages and did a whole bunch of really criminal stuff that we haven't even heard of yet. So I guess the question I have is, why is this important? Why am I still talking about TARP? Why am I still talking about 2008? Why am I still talking about Bush and the bailouts? Why am I talking about them? Well, I think it's important to look at what's going on right now in the state budgets. If 2008 doesn't happen, if we just come sailing right along, we don't have this massive collapse where the floor falls out from under us. We aren't talking about cutting education. We're not talking about cutting Social Security. We're not talking about cutting Medicare. We're not talking about stealing wages from workers and cutting jobs and cut, cut, cut. We're not talking about that. But here we are, after the collapse that nearly put this country into a depression, talking about cutting $1 billion from K through 12 education. A 56% cut to higher education funding. That's the future, man. And while we're doing that, while we're talking about slashing there, we're talking about privatizing and profitizing education by starting some bizarre voucher program, some bizarre lottery program. And today, Acting Secretary of Education Ronald Tomlis, told the Trib Review that raising property taxes, firing teachers, and increasing class sizes are among the difficult decisions state budget cuts will force school districts to make. You got to give the guy credit. He's being at least honest. Look, school districts, you're screwed. Local property tax owners, payers, you're screwed. We're going to keep our pledge, no tax increases. We're going to let the drillers go free. We're going to let the Delaware loophole stay open. All that other stuff, we're going to let that go. You folks at the bottom, like I say, it rolls downhill. So he's defending these big, massive, deep, drastic budget cuts in education before the House and Senate Appropriations Committee. And he says this is coming down hard on those school districts. This is Stuart Greenleaf, Republican, who says, you know, these cuts are coming to school districts that don't have surpluses, where enrollment is increasing or flat. I need you to reevaluate the situation for these schools. Another Republican, Mario Scavello, Monroe County, read a long list of cuts in his local districts that had announced. He says they're in trouble. They need help. But at the end of this, it comes down to keeping that bizarre pledge. Here's the thing. Several lawmakers said, you know what, these cuts are going to hurt us. And they're going to make us raise property taxes. So at the end of this, cutting spending sounded like a great thing on the campaign trail. Sounded great. Now that it's coming home, now that we're realizing what's going on, maybe not such a great idea. So as we move down the road, we're seeing half of Pennsylvania's 500 school districts that are considering exemptions to Act 1. You'll remember the 2006 Taxpayer Relief Act that was supposed to only raise property taxes a little bit. Well, you know, they're seeking exemptions. And I'm not sure how that's going to go. But I love the quote. I love this. The acting secretary of education said, and this is the Republican frame, man. It's not always about the money. He says, the biggest frustration I have with public education is we measure commitment and we measure success by input. We really need to focus more on output measures. And I look to a study done by Stanford University, who looked at these charter schools and all the things that the Republicans seem to love to push. You know, transferring money from public schools to charter schools or to private schools. This Stanford University research study said that only 17% of charter schools had better outcomes than local public schools. 17%. And in that movie, Waiting for Superman, they loved beating up on the public schools. They loved beating up on the unionized teachers. They loved beating up on tenure. And they loved saying the fact that Finland was the country that had the world's best education. Well, let me leave you with one thing. Finland has the highest rate of unionized teachers in the world and tenure. The difference is they have a child poverty rate at 3%. We have a child poverty rate at 22%. Stop and think about that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Oral arguments were heard Tuesday in Dukes versus Walmart, the biggest sexual discrimination lawsuit in U.S. history. A U.S. Supreme Court decision on the suit against Walmart is expected by early summer. The case is about whether women who work or worked for Walmart can come together as a class to sue over allegedly discriminatory pay and promotion practices. The workers say although women make up two-thirds of Walmart employees, just 14% of managers are women, and women at Walmart also make less money despite having higher average seniority. If the Supreme Court allows them to come together legally as a class, millions of workers could join the suit, and Walmart could potentially be forced to pay tens of billions of dollars. On Monday, April 4th, we are one as labor, faith groups, and community organizations nationwide stand together in solidarity to mark the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Jesse Russell has more.
April 4th, 1968. An assassin's bullet takes the life of Reverend Martin Luther King, who was in Memphis, Tennessee, to support black sanitary workers who had been striking since March 12th. The workers were demanding treatment equal to their white peers. On April 4th, 2011, labor organizations, workers, and the faith community plan to stand together in solidarity in cities across the United States. They are calling the one-day event, We Are One, to both honor King, but to also show unified strength in the face of legislation in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio that seeks to strip the right of workers to collectively bargain. Arlene Holt Baker is Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO and a board member for Interfaith Worker Justice. On Tuesday, she explained the significance of the rally next Monday.
And today, just as in Memphis in 1968, nurses and teachers, students, firefighters, small business owners, and all working people are standing together. We honor Dr. King with our determination to stand up to this political overreach and ensure we build the future our children deserve.
The Autonomous Solidarity Organization, a new group of activists formed in the Madison pro-labor protests, is touring Wisconsin college campuses in an effort to get out the vote for the April 5th Wisconsin State Supreme Court race. Justice candidate Joanne Kloppenburg is backed by labor in Wisconsin, and this will be the first test of electoral power of the Wisconsin pro-labor movement sparked by the Republican attack on public worker collective bargaining rights. The group traveled with Jesse Jackson Monday and Tuesday for a series of campus rallies. Spokesman David Vines.
In the long term, our goal is to advocate for workers' rights, students' rights, the right for the middle class. We've had a tremendous trip so far. We've had a ton of positive response from the people that we've seen, the people that have been around us.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Well, you know, that's what the college kids this week did here in Harrisburg. More than 1,000 of them came and had their voices heard in their capital. The other day we went to Kutztown University and saw hundreds of people come out. The beginning of this is happening. We're seeing a groundswell, especially from people who are looking to the future going, they're talking about cutting half, 56% of higher education funding? Really? And they're looking at it going, that's my future. They're basically sentencing these kids to what I'm saying is a death sentence. Because if in this economy, if you don't have an education, you are sentenced to a life of low pay, misery, and suffering. It's that simple. Anyway, I got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the phone. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us, buddy.
Hey, good to be with you, Rick.
You know, we spent a couple of days Monday, you know, at the rally here in Harrisburg, Tuesday, the rally in Kutztown, seeing these kids coming together. And I'm telling you, this is exciting stuff.
It's very exciting stuff. And one of the most exciting things was that one of the speakers at the rally at the Capitol was a guy named Rick Smith.
Yeah.
And, he ignited that crowd of young people who came together to hear and see and touch for themselves that which they've only been hearing about and reading about. It's a really good education. It's really enrolling every one of these kids in a PhD program about how their government really works and how a bill really becomes a law.
Yep. You know, I talked about Wisconsin, you know, the fact that we went out for a week there to Wisconsin, not only to be part of history, but to see how things are going to, I think, have to happen here in our state.
Yeah, well, clearly they have to happen here, and they have to happen now. There is, and I've said this in other ways on your show and other places for some time now, there is no single greater, more significant touchstone to democracy than access to a good quality public education. Public education in elementary school, public education in secondary school, and public education in post-secondary situations, colleges, of course, sustained by the taxpayers in this state, as they have been for so many years, to give the little people, real working people's children, an opportunity for a higher education to get their piece of the pie. I'm always reminded of those wonderful words in the Billy Joel song, Allentown. Every kid had a pretty good shot at getting at least as far as their old man got.
Yep.
And this Corbett budget, this slash and burn of education, is the public political policy aimed at slashing that dream, destroying that dream, crushing that dream.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because at the rally here in Harrisburg, I talked to a young man who said, you know, my grandfather worked in this factory in our town, and up until 10 years ago, my father worked in that factory. He goes, if I can't do this, if I can't get a college education and make something of myself, I don't have that to go back to. And that really struck a chord with me, because the reality is our trade policies, the fact that we've allowed companies to flee this country at an alarming rate, has left really the uneducated with nothing.
Absolutely. No opportunity, no meaningful chance. First they exported our jobs to the South, and then they exported the jobs from the South to Central America, and then they exported the jobs from Central America to Asia, and now they're trying to drive us down in a fashion so they can bring the jobs back here and pay us nothing but not have the export fees to bring them back from China and India and Sri Lanka and Vietnam and Hong Kong and who knows where else.
And one of the other speakers I talked to said, you know, basically what they want is they want an uneducated, and it's the old George Carlin quote as well. They want a populace just smart enough to run their machines, but not smart enough to ask why that's all they can do.
Well, that's exactly what they had in the Pennsylvania of 100 years ago, and it's what spurred on the organization of the industries in this state. It's what spurred the recognition of the strafing of our environment being inappropriate and impermissible. It's what spurred on access to public education so that the Serbian and Croatian and Irish and German and Dutch and Italian immigrants that made up the Pennsylvania of a century ago would have an opportunity for their children to have a better life and for their children's children to have a better life yet. And it seems that that must be offensive to the political leaders and the captains of industry who are in league with one another and propose budgets that slash 56% out of higher education, that slash 50% out of public education, and then impose $1 billion worth of unfunded mandates to strip even $1 billion more out of it after they take 10% away in some hocus-pocus program they call vouchers.
Yeah, the lottery program.
The lottery program. But it's not a lottery. At least the lottery isn't rigged. Some gets to win.
Yeah, at least you have somewhere to take that, that lottery ticket when you win to have it validated.
Yeah, and in their lottery that you call lottery, the people who buy the tickets don't all get to have a ticket that, that might win. It's rigged against them. The vast majority of the tickets won't win, and a small minority that have already won get to win again and again and again, all paid for by the people who are guaranteed to lose.
You know, personally, I again, you know, you look at what's going on across this country. It's the same blueprint. You know, I don't see what Corbett's doing here in Pennsylvania as anything different than Walker's doing in Wisconsin or Kasich's doing in Ohio or the guy who steals candy from children up in Maine. It's all the same game plan. Just privatize everything that is ours, education, state stores, turnpikes, whatever. Steal the assets, privatize them, profitize them, and destroy workers' rights.
Well, very clearly the goal in every place that you mentioned and so many more is the same. But the methodology behind what they're doing is different. And, you know, they keep on telling us the states are places to experiment. They're not experimenting with the results that they seek. They're only experimenting with the methods by which they attempt to do it to us. So in Wisconsin, they made it illegal for public sector unions to exist. In Pennsylvania, they didn't make it illegal for public sector unions to exist, but they told all the public sector unions before they sat down at the table, we're not going to let you have the opportunity to do what your members pay you to do. So, you know, the result sought is exactly the same. The methodology is different, and attempting to condemn workers and their children to death by a thousand.
Yeah, I mean, because the reality is, you know, in the 90s, they told us, you know, we're going to get rid of these dirty factory jobs, and we're going to move to the knowledge-based economy, and we're going to train workers to do these knowledge jobs. Well, if you don't have that training and you don't have the ability to get that training, what are you left with? And that's where, you know, I go back to the kids that I met at these rallies, and I go, you know, what's their future look like? What's the future of the state of Pennsylvania look like if we don't have a top-rate educated populace?
Well, you know, we're being told that in very plain ways. In the last 25 to 30 years, the population of the United States has increased by approximately 50%, from about 200 million to better than 300 million. But the population of Pennsylvania is about the same today as it was 30 years ago. So by all that's right, our population should have increased by 50%. When it doesn't increase by 50%, it's because they're dashing our opportunities here. They're telling our children to move away. And they're telling them to move away earlier and earlier. First, they told them to move away when they said there weren't jobs here. Now they're telling them, move away before you learn about there not being jobs, because we're not going to give you a chance to get an education either. As a parent of four young adult children, I'm worried about this. I'm scared by it. I'd like to be able to hold my grandchildren on my knee and on my lap in my home, not in some place in South Carolina. Not that I have anything against South Carolina, but I'm a Pennsylvanian, and we're Pennsylvanians. And Pennsylvania has been pretty good to us, and I don't know why these political leaders and their corporate bigwig supporters want to strafe us again and again and again. Those of us who don't recognize history, as was said by a philosopher far wiser than I, are doomed to repeat it.
And it seems that's exactly what we're doing. We're moving ourselves right back to the late 1800s.
Yeah, it seems that way.
And, you know, I look at this voucher program, and everywhere that I've seen any reporting on it, any studies done, it's failed. I mean, we're talking about cutting $1 billion to K-12 education while simultaneously setting up a lottery voucher, whatever you want to call it, program that's going to cost us another $1 billion over 10 years.
Well, you know, it would be bad enough if they were just stripping $1 billion. But what they're doing is they're creating unfunded mandate for the very taxpayers that they claim to be protecting. And they're saying that these taxpayers have to pay this $1 billion over to the snooty private schools that the rich kids get to go to the Baldwin School in suburban Philadelphia, or to Winchester Thurston School, or Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh, or the Harrisburg Academy here in central Pennsylvania. And shockingly, just today, a study came out, was published from, of all places, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's right, Rick, Wisconsin. And that study was breathtaking. The Milwaukee School District has had a voucher program for 21 years. And the first study of its kind came out just today, was published today, and it demonstrated that only 17% of the children in these voucher programs had test results that were actually better than the kids who were in the public schools. 83% were equal to or below the performance of the kids in the public schools, even after they stripped for 21 years the money out of the public school system to put it in the hands of the privateers. How much more evidence do we need? How much more evidence do we need? And then we have the charter schools that were supposed to be an experiment. Where are those charter schools with the allegedly good results passing the information along that the taxpayers paid for in financing those charter schools to the traditional public schools so that we can have an opportunity to at least put into practice those couple of things that they may have found that were actually better?
Yep. You know, I was looking at USA Today, and they were talking about some of the questionable results in like Washington D.C., one of the schools that they've really touted as the big charter school that evidently they've got twice the eraser mark than the rest of the average or whatever, kind of leading to the thought that they may not be on the up and up.
Well, we know that there are charter schools that are operating in Pennsylvania in many instances are not only not on the up and up, but they're just front groups for literally extricating taxpayer money from the taxpayers and putting it in the pockets of the profiteers. We saw what happened when one member of the General Assembly, a state senator from Philadelphia who's a big supporter of charter schools named Tony Williams, announced that he was considering running for governor in the Pennsylvania primary. Three charter school billionaires gave him over $6 million in contributions to run his campaign.
Wow.
Simply because he was a charter school supporter.
Okay, I guess it takes me back to what my grandfather always said. If a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better get it. Or in this case, that you need something, you better figure out how to stay away from it.
Well, you got to. We need to stand up in line. This education policy that we have had articulated to us now for the last 3.5 weeks since the governor's budget message was put out is the greatest single assault I have seen on freedom and democracy in this state in my life. And I have been going around sounding the alarm and spreading the word because while every possible cut is painful, denying children access to a way up and a way through by giving them the fundamental tools is maybe the most cynical and the most obstreperous of all possible slashes. What does the government exist for if not to protect our children?
That's an excellent question. Well, let me ask you, maybe in their defense, do you think that they really believe that privatizing education is going to lead to better outcomes, or is this just their basic core belief that the government can do nothing and that there's nothing that we, the people, should be doing?
I think the latter is the excuse for the former. I think that they have a debt to pay to the people who sent them to the party, and they do it by articulating these grandiose ideas about public schools are somehow flawed, for example, and so we have to transfer it to the privateers. But, you know, they point to examples that just don't make it. They blame unions for the failure of public schools, but don't blame the school boards. They blame unions, and particularly teacher unions, for policies that are adopted not by the unions but by the school boards. And they point to other countries and say how much better schools do in other countries than they do here. We got to fix this, the system that's broken. Well, the other countries they compare us to, like China, like Hong Kong, like Korea, don't have universal access to public education. Only the elite get to go to schools. The rest of the population gets relegated to where they want to relegate our kids by unfunding education. So how do we compare them to us? Then they compare us to Finland, and they announce how much better the outcomes are for kids who are in school in Finland. Well, guess what? 91% of the teachers in Finland are unionized, as compared with less than 50% here in the United States. So is it the unions that are to blame? Or is there some other issue?
I think some other issue. And the poverty rate, as I've seen it in Finland, for children is about 3%. Compared to here, numbers around 22%.
That's absolutely correct.
And you know, you look at it, you go, well, there's a pretty
well,
good...
Duh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, we keep hearing this going out. We've got to save education. We've got to save education. These cuts can't happen. What's the answer then down the road? I mean, because, you know, I keep hearing people saying, oh, you know, we've got a budget problem. Times are tough. We've got to sacrifice. What's the answer?
Well, I think the answer is to get real. Education is not a cost. Education is an investment. We give our kids an education, and that brings jobs here. It brings jobs because an educated workforce is the workforce that employers are looking for. And then we have this, once again, this extraordinary natural resource that we have found that is being lifted from the ground of Pennsylvania and transported across the country called the Marcellus Shale gas field. And why it's off base to have an extraction tax that protects our environment and maybe pays to educate a generation of workers from Pennsylvania who could work in those fields instead of importing people from Oklahoma and Texas, like all the license plates I see up there when I drive up there show me. What's wrong with that? How is that bad? Even West Virginia, even Texas, even Oklahoma taxes gas extraction and oil extraction. But Pennsylvania can't, and Pennsylvania won't.
But didn't you know if we tax them, they won't come?
Well, I'd like to know where they're going to drill that gas, Rick. If they won't come here because we tax them, are they going to gas somehow by drilling a hole in Nebraska and then going horizontally across country to Pennsylvania underground?
They just may try.
I fear that I may have given somebody an idea.
I didn't want to let that out. Irwin, I appreciate your time, buddy. Always great talking with you.
Pleasure's all mine. Good to talk to you, and keep up the good work. Keep inspiring those kids. They need it.
Yes, sir. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Took him some 80 years, but he has now made what looks to be a full comeback to power. He is Herbert Hoover. With the Great Depression spreading misery across America, President Hoover's prescription was to insist on reducing the size and spending of governments in order to boost business confidence. Hoovernomics was a disaster for our country, and was not good for him. He lost the presidency in 1932 to FDR. So here we are in a new century, with widespread, relentless unemployment, mass underemployment, stagnant wages, a rapidly falling middle class, and dimming economic prospects, even for college-educated young Americans. In the face of this destabilizing, inegalitarian pressure on our economy and society, what remedy are America's corporate and political leaders demanding? Hoovernomics. Not a single jobs bill is in the congressional hopper. Despite rhetoric about a new green economy, the White House has offered no job creation plans at all. Instead, Washington's entire energy is going down the Hoover hole of restoring business confidence. The deficit is the devil, cry the new Hooverites, as they wildly slash spending and try to kill federal programs like Head Start that lift people up. Not to be outdone, a covey of extremist right-wing governors are demonizing, disempowering, and firing thousands of public employees. These little Hoovers maniacally shriek that with state revenues down and so many families out of work, the smart thing to do is to eliminate more jobs. They're shoving teachers, firefighters, and other public employees out the door, thus shutting off the taxes that these employees pay to the state while simultaneously increasing the number of out-of-work people looking for jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Hoovernomics is back, as goofy and destructive today as it was last century.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Got an email during the break. This needs to be mentioned along with the slashing of education funding across our great country. Why isn't Texas in the media, why isn't Texas in the media more concerning the rewriting of the nation's textbooks? Up to 47 other states purchased these books from Texas. The Christian right targeted the Board of Education in the elections and promoted their agenda. This is crazy. I don't understand why more parents aren't upset about how this will affect their children's education. Not only that, Texas is 43rd in education in the nation and are slashing funding for education as well. Why would other states want to buy textbooks from a state with a national education level of 43? Is the Republican slash Christian right dumbing down the next generation of American children? Is that their goal? Slash funding and make them stupid? Well, yeah, that is their goal. You know, I think George Carlin always hit it on the right key. Maybe they want us dumb enough not to realize how badly we're getting screwed. And when you talk to people who, you know, look at a problem, they always go to the simplest, the lowest common denominator. So when they say that jobs are leaving the country and it's government's fault, they don't look at the companies that are doing it. When they see any number of situations, it's always the easiest target. And government's always the easiest target. They look at their paychecks and they go, my paycheck sucks. But those people over there are making more than I do. Tear them down. Those public workers, they've got health care. And they only have to pay 3, 5, or 8% for it. I've got to pay 20% for mine. They should have to pay 20%. Instead of saying, how about me? I'd like to pay 2 or 3 or 5%. In fact, I don't think we should have to pay for education. I think or health care. It should be something that we do as a nation. It should be a single-payer program where it's just a matter of course where you don't have to worry about going bankrupt in the event that you get sick, that you don't have to worry about losing your home in the event that you get sick. To me, it just is a matter of course. And, you know, we've been trained for the last 30 years to think that anything that we do as a collective, anything we do as a society, somehow that's bad. And whatever the individual does, no matter how destructive or stupid, is good. You know, I go back and I talked to a guy who did some relief work in Haiti. And he said that, you know, one of the dumbest things he ever saw, and the guy's heart was in the right place. He just didn't have a brain cell in his head. He flew from Florida to Haiti with an airplane full of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and bottled water. Didn't speak the language. Didn't know anybody. But his heart was in the right place. Just his head wasn't. And maybe we do need a little help there. Amazing stuff. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dan Kane. He's the Secretary Treasurer of the United Mine Workers of America. Today a big day for them. The federal mine health safety bill went through. Also, a big event coming up April 1st. We're going to take a break right back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Today, back in 1970, the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act was enacted. And, you know, you look at all of the tragedies that have happened over the last several years, you know, and I'm still hearing this frame. And it was the other night at the Cumberland County Commissioners debate there at the 912 Kooks conference that the guy stood up and said, well, you know, we needed unions, well, back then. Back when we were doing coal and people were getting injured in the coal mines, kind of shows how far they are disconnected from the realities of today. But today, the day that the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act was enacted, that's why I've asked Dan Kane, United Mine Workers of America Secretary Treasurer, to come talk to us about this. And there's a big event coming up on April 1st. Dan?
My pleasure.
You know, I look at this bill and you go, this is a major step forward to protecting miners, but we've seen a lot of accidents over the last couple of years.
Well, we're coming off a particularly bad year, especially with the tragedy at Upper Big Branch, and it just demonstrates that strict laws are very important, but what's also important is enforcement.
Absolutely.
The minute enforcement lags, the danger can come back into the mines in a split second. So we need vigorous enforcement, and it has to be continual.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, I've had conversations with some of my conservative friends. Well, you know, unions had their day. Back when, you know, there were dangerous conditions, you needed that unity, you needed the union there to protect the workers. But we have laws today, so we don't need them anymore. And the way I'm looking at this is I'm going, you know, we need both. Because as you've said, you need the enforcement, but you also need to have the voice on the job to be able to enact or to be able to use those rules.
Absolutely. People forget that the employer has tremendous power in the workplace. And we've seen how health and safety laws can be ignored with impunity sometimes. Labor laws can be ignored with absolute impunity. The individual worker, whether he's a miner or a construction worker or a factory worker or works in an office, needs someone there who can stand up for him every minute of the working day. And unions are the only ones that will do that. That's just one of the many functions that unions perform. Health and safety is the most critical. We like to remind people that in the mines, we go to work there. We don't go to die.
Right.
And too often, injury and death is the result of lax or no enforcement.
You know, you brought up the Upper Big Branch mine, and it brought me back to the thought of Mr. Blankenship, the former CEO there, who you know, and I'm paraphrasing, who basically wrote to them saying, "Look, your job is not to do anything but run coal. That's what pays the bills. We don't care about anything else. You just pump out the product."
You know, I'm amazed that he put that in the form of a memo. He did, and I guess it just shows you the arrogance that occurs when people think they're above the law, when people think they're beyond the reach of the labor movement. When I first got wind of the Upper Big Branch disaster, that the whole mine blew up, that doesn't happen with just a methane explosion. That's always a combination of an ignition source like methane followed by a coal dust explosion. Coal dust explosions only happen when there has been a neglect of rock dust for a long period of time. And that's not something that occurs by accident. It's absolute criminal neglect. And I believe that the facts will ultimately show that there was dramatically insufficient rock dusting in Upper Big Branch. And it resulted in the whole mine exploding.
Yeah, but my problem with this, and, you know, I believe it's criminal. Why don't we ever see any of these people put on trial and locked up? I mean, they tell us they want corporations to be like people. Why aren't we locking these people up?
That's a good question, and it's about time we do. It's about time that we enforce safety regulations with criminal violations. It's about time that we force labor law violations with criminal, you know, criminal sanctions. The big corporations have gotten so powerful. It's back to the days of the robber baron. We're at a point in our history where a small percentage of the population controls most of the wealth of this creek. They have put people who will do their bidding in political office. They own the news media. They put people who will sing their praises in the schools. These are the people that are even teaching our children. They have such control that it's absolutely unfathomable, and they've done it so slyly, they're so slick about it, that some people haven't noticed, and they don't notice until it's too late.
Well, do you think these attacks, and one of the people that come to mind when you said that was Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Kasich in Ohio and all of these right-wing governors who are attacking workers, at what point do the American people rise up and say no more? At what point does the American workforce turn into an Egypt or a Tunisia?
Well, I don't know. We are approaching that direction rapidly. People are starting to wake up, and we in the labor movement are determined that we're not going to take it. We are going to be out in force. The mine workers are going to Pennsylvania on April 1st to kick some of this off with a Mitchell Day celebration, which is going to it's going to publicize some of the things that are going on, and we're not going to stop. Working people have to be determined that they're going to continue to protest and fight for their rights. We can't go back to the days whenever we lived in company houses and had to shop in company stores and were paid in script. You know, I get around to schools occasionally and tell people what it's like or what it was like back the turn of the last century for coal miners. And many other industries were no better. And they can't believe it. They can't believe it. They say, well, that could never happen in this country. And I remind them, it not only could, it did. And if you don't watch, it'll happen again. They already have such tremendous control, and the arrogance of these right-wing politicians is a good example of that.
Yep. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Dan Kane, United Mine Workers of America Secretary Treasurer. You bring up that's an interesting point. You know, when I heard Scott Walker with the phony phone call, a little bit later we're going to talk with Ian Murphy, the guy who made the phony phone call to the governor, pretending to be one of the Koch brothers. When this guy Murphy said, as one of the Koch brothers, we should just let's send in some troublemakers. And Walker said, well, you know, we thought of that. The hair on every working person's neck should have stood straight on end, and there should have been a massive outcry. Now, in Wisconsin, there was. But I talked to my friends here back in Pennsylvania, not so much.
Well, the mine workers are going to see if we can't change that the day after tomorrow and start moving things. We recognize that this isn't going to be a sprint because they're not going to give up in a day or a month. It's going to be an ongoing battle. But we have to start putting more pressure on them, and we have to keep it there. We have to do voter registration like we've never done before. We have to do voter education.
Absolutely.
And we have to get out there. We have to get in people's face and get our message out there and make it plain what's going on. We stand to lose our way of life. We stand to lose the middle class. People have to recognize that we didn't get pensions out of the goodness of the heart of the robber baron.
Oh, you mean the benevolent corporation didn't say, we like you guys so much here, have this?
Yeah, exactly. Have weekends. The reason we have paid vacations and health and safety laws. Listen, something as fundamental as child labor. The reason our kids get to go to school now when they're 9 or 10 is because of the labor movement. Many people in the coal fields can tell you these stories. My granddad had to quit school in the 7th grade and work the rest of his life in the coal mine. He didn't do that because he wanted to. He did it because he had to. He had to help support the family. And we could go back there real quick. We've gone from so many millions of single-income, family-sustaining jobs to a point now where most families require two incomes to get by.
And that is a serious problem. And one of the things I think has happened, and this is, and don't take this the wrong way, but a knock on labor is that they haven't told their story. Such as on Mitchell Day, which is April 1st, the United Mine Workers of America's 1 in 8 hour day back in 1898. It was labor that made the 8 hour day. It wasn't the benevolence of a corporation. It wasn't the benevolence of a politician. It was working people coming together collectively saying, you know what? We'd like to see our families occasionally and we'd like to have a decent night's sleep.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we do have to speak louder. We do have to speak stronger. We need the help to a greater extent of the people that we support to put in office. You know, we won a presidential election, you know, a few years ago, and we won a lot of Senate and House seats, and we were really enthused about the Employee Free Choice Act. Here was a chance for workers to get a voice on the job away from the intimidation of the bosses. And I'll tell you what, for anybody who's worked in organizing, it is the most frustrating job. The employer will break the law routinely again. And again and again. It's illegal to fire workers in an organizing drive, but it happens in the majority of organizing drives. And if there's any justice, it doesn't happen until about 6 or 7 years later. And the only thing the employer has to do is they have to pay back pay and give the person their job back. You know, I've told people before, that's like if you get caught robbing a bank and you're going out the door and the police catch you and your penalty is you have to give the money back and say you won't do it again. Now, if that's the way we enforced our criminal laws, the streets wouldn't be safe. But that's how it is in the workplace with labor laws, and that's how it is with health and safety laws. There has to be tougher enforcement.
I'm right there with you.
I think the folks that we support for office need to step up and recognize that they haven't done for us everything they can.
And what it was, I think after the 2008 election, everybody went home. We thought we won. Everybody said, hey, you know, they're going to take care of it. We put our people in. They're going to take care of it. And look what ended up happening.
I know. Well, the price of freedom in the workplace is eternal vigilance.
Yep.
And we got to do a better job at that. All of us.
So last question I've got for you, about a minute and a half here. On April 1st, big celebration, Waynesboro, PA?
Waynesburg.
Waynesburg.
Yeah.
Give me a little background of why it's an important day in the United Mine Work of America history. A little bit of background there, just for a little education.
Well, listen, Mitchell Day is our commemorance of the 8-hour day. We name it Mitchell Day in honor of John Mitchell, who was one of our early presidents, who was really a miner's hero, led an anthracite strike that got recognition of the union for the first time. And that's our celebration of the 8-hour day. That's critical to us. We also use it, it's a holiday in most UMWA contracts. And we're going to use the Mitchell Day holiday this year. We're expecting several thousand people to show up. And we want to talk about a number of issues. First off, we picked that area because we have a company up there who's made a tremendous amount of money on two of our operations, which are extremely productive. And they're trying to put in two new operations to replace them when they're mined out, and they want to put them in non-union. We're not going to let them do that.
I hope
not. We want to send a firm message to them. If you try to run them non-union, they're not going to run. We're going to do everything we have to do to see that the people who made them the money keep the jobs. And we're also going to talk about a good deal about what's going on with the attack on public employees. I think it's important that we reject these divide and conquer tactics right now that are going on in our states. And I remind people all the time that they're trying to pick out public employees because people think, well, we pay them. Well, guess what? In this economy, everybody pays everybody else.
That's exactly right.
Every time you get a car loan, you pay the banker.
Yep, and that's why
every time you buy gas, you pay the CEO of the oil company. So we are one, and we're going to be everywhere.
We are one. Beautiful. And that's why we have to stand together during this time. Dan Cain, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the conversation.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around. It's time for war.
values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Oral arguments were heard Tuesday in Dukes versus Walmart, the biggest sexual discrimination lawsuit in U.S. history. A U.S. Supreme Court decision on the suit against Walmart is expected by early summer. The case is about whether women who work or worked for Walmart can come together as a class to sue over allegedly discriminatory pay and promotion practices. The workers say although women make up two-thirds of Walmart employees, just 14% of managers are women, and women at Walmart also make less money despite having higher average seniority. If the Supreme Court allows them to come together legally as a class, millions of workers could join the suit, and Walmart could potentially be forced to pay tens of billions of dollars. On Monday, April 4th, we are one as labor, faith groups, and community organizations nationwide stand together in solidarity to mark the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Jesse Russell has more.
April 4th, 1968. An assassin's bullet takes the life of Reverend Martin Luther King, who was in Memphis, Tennessee, to support black sanitary workers who had been striking since March 12th. The workers were demanding treatment equal to their white peers. On April 4th, 2011, labor organizations, workers, and the faith community plan to stand together in solidarity in cities across the United States. They are calling the one-day event, We Are One, to both honor King, but to also show unified strength in the face of legislation in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio that seeks to strip the right of workers to collectively bargain. Arlene Holt-Baker is Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO and a board member for Interfaith Worker Justice. On Tuesday, she explained the significance of the rally next Monday.
And today, just as in Memphis in 1968, nurses and teachers, students, firefighters, small business owners, and all working people are standing together. We honor Dr. King with our determination to stand up to this political overreach and ensure we build the future our children deserve.
The Autonomous Solidarity Organization, a new group of activists formed in the Madison pro-labor protests, is touring Wisconsin college campuses in an effort to get out the vote for the April 5th Wisconsin State Supreme Court race. Justice candidate Joanne Kloppenburg is backed by labor in Wisconsin, and this will be the first test of electoral power of the Wisconsin pro-labor movement sparked by the Republican attack on public worker collective bargaining rights. The group traveled with Jesse Jackson Monday and Tuesday for a series of campus rallies. Spokesman David Vines.
In the long term, our goal is to advocate for workers' rights, students' rights, the rights of the middle class. We've had a tremendous trip so far. We've had a ton of positive response from the people that we've seen, the people that have been around us.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time will change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, with this being Women's History Month, I got to be honest, I was surprised to find out that there's no museum recognizing the achievements, accomplishments, or contributions of women in our nation. Evidently, though, today the National Women's History Museum group held a rally at the Capitol to do just that. That's why I've asked Joan Wages, president of the National Women's History Museum, to come talk to us a little bit. Joan, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure.
You know, I understand today Susan Collins and Representative Carolyn Mahoney of New York announced some legislation to find a place to put a Women's History Museum.
Yes, they reintroduced legislation. They were sponsors of our legislation last session of Congress, and we were very close to getting the bill passed. So now it's being reintroduced, but with great momentum.
Why didn't we get it passed before?
Well, at the very tail end of the session, two male senators placed a hold on our bill.
I'm guessing DeMint was probably one of them.
One of them. Bingo.
And I'm guessing they were both Republicans, so I...
Yes, they were. Yeah. The other one was Tom Coburn.
I guess that kind of surprises me a little bit. But DeMint, no surprise there at all. Let's talk about this idea of a women's history museum. You know, because at this time where, you know, the economy, they keep saying we need to cut spending, we need to find budget cuts and all this stuff. Where would we put it? Who would pay for it? That kind of stuff.
We have a site identified that's right at 12th and Independence Avenue, and that is the street that borders the mall. So we would be directly across the street from the National Mall. Great location. And the legislation says that we will purchase the site at fair market value, and we will pay for the construction of the building with private monies. We are not asking the federal government for one dime.
Okay, well, that's a good thing, I guess. You know, some of the crazy. So why would Coburn and DeMint be against it?
Well, you know, there's the reason that Coburn says, and then I think there's the real reason, which I don't know. But Coburn put out a list of other sites across the country that recognize women, like the Cowgirl Museum in Texas and the Quilting Museum in Ohio and the Lilac Garden here in Washington. And because these other places exist, he says that our museum would be duplicative, and so we should not have it.
Ah, well, I guess on some twisted level, it must make sense to somebody. Not me, but, you know, on some twisted level, it makes sense to somebody.
Well, you know, if that were the basis on which a museum is built here in Washington, we would have none.
Because
each one of the museums, there are museums of similar nature, even more similar nature than the ones I just identified about women's history. But the point in having a museum here in Washington is so that our citizens and people from around the world can come to learn about the history of this nation in one place.
You know, here's the thing, and I think this is a great idea, Joan. I've got two daughters who, you know, to be honest, I hope for them. I've got an 8-year-old and a 2-year-old daughters, and my hope for them is that they achieve whatever it is they're capable of achieving, and being able to look at other girls and other women who have achieved and are doing well, I think makes a good role model, makes a good example for them to emulate.
And that's exactly the reason why we want and need this museum, because women's history is left out of our current history textbooks. Only 1 in 10 figures in today's history textbooks is of a woman leader. And I mean, if you look around our national parks, less than 5% of the statues are about women.
Yeah, but here's the thing. But in Texas, you know, I was just looking at some Texas textbook stuff. Phyllis Schlafly's in the textbook. She's a woman, isn't she? She's insane, but she's a woman.
but comparatively, very little. I mean, even when you're counting that, very little is about women.
I agree. You know, here's my problem, though. I think there, and this is my personal view. You don't have to come with me on this journey.
Okay.
But I believe that there's a very concerted effort to roll back all of the movement forward that women have made over the last 100 years. There's a concerted effort to put my daughters barefoot and pregnant back in the kitchen, out of the workforce, all of those things. And I can see folks would not want to have a museum where women are viewed as empowered figures who have succeeded and achieved.
Well, I think that's the key, is that history is very empowering. Drew Faust, who's the president of Harvard, says, who is a historian, says that history lights a path to the future. So if we don't know our history and women don't know our history, then it makes it far more difficult to succeed in the future, because women continually think that they have to reinvent the wheel. They don't know that women have some shoulders to stand on. as far as what women have accomplished.
Right.
So it is very empowering, and maybe there are some who don't want women to know their history just for that reason. But I think the genie's out of the bottle.
I'm with you. Joan Wages, president of the National Women's History Museum. Their website, www.nwhm.org. You can get there from our website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, just last week we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fair that killed 146 women. Is something like that something that you would include in this museum? Because after all, that whole movement toward that day was about empowering women in the workforce to have a voice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we just did a video that's on our website that includes that story and how that led to, you know, many things, but the recognition that women were not being treated fairly or paid fairly and all kinds of things. So, absolutely, that will be part of the story.
Yeah, because those are stories that I tell my daughters, because I think it's important that they understand that they do have the ability to make their lives better. And, you know, I look at the crazy guy up in Maine, the guy who, you know, beats up children and steals their candy at Halloween, who's their governor now, who's renaming the rooms in their Department of Labor, taking one of the rooms away from Frances Perkins, who,
yeah,
you know, was the first female cabinet member, just happened to be the Department of Labor. I look at that as another slap in the face, not only to workers, but also to women.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I guess that there will be those who will see it as an offense that women have achieved. But again, I think that the majority of people are supporting women and women having equality.
All right, I'm with you on that. How do we help? What's the game plan here? Where's the time frame? Because as soon as it's open, I'm going to bring my daughters. So tell me how this is going to go forward.
That's great. We are hoping the legislation is going to be passed this year. It will probably take us 5 to 7 years to build this museum, to raise the money, to build the building. And so people can go to our website, nwhm.org, and read all about women's history. They can become a charter member of the museum and support us. They can contact their member of Congress, urge them to sign our petition on our website, and urge their members of Congress to support the legislation when it comes up for a vote.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that, you know, if we've got museums honoring the robber barons of this country, the least we should be able to do is have a museum to honor the women who made this. Well, you know, like my mother, who brought me into this world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the motherhood absolutely has to be a part of this, because that's certainly a major role that women have played.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't make it without my wife. She stays home, and people say, oh, your wife stays home. That's too much work for me. And I work 14, 16-hour days. That's still too much work for me.
Right. I know, because hers is 24/7.
That's right. Right on the spot. Joan Wages, president of the National Women's History Museum, nwhm.org. There's a spot on our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Joan Wages' name. Take you right there. I appreciate your time. Great talking to you with you, and best of luck. When this moves forward, we'd love to have you back on again.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
It took him some 80 years, but he has now made what looks to be a full comeback to power. He is Herbert Hoover. With the Great Depression spreading misery across America, President Hoover's prescription was to insist on reducing the size and spending of governments in order to boost business confidence. Hoovernomics was a disaster for our country, and it was not good for him. He lost the presidency in 1932 to FDR. So here we are in a new century, with widespread, relentless unemployment, mass underemployment, stagnant wages, a rapidly falling middle class, and dimming economic prospects, even for college-educated young Americans. In the face of this destabilizing, inegalitarian pressure on our economy and society, what remedy are America's corporate and political leaders demanding? Hoovernomics. Not a single jobs bill is in the congressional hopper. Despite rhetoric about a new green economy, the White House has offered no job creation plans at all. Instead, Washington's entire energy is going down the Hoover hole of restoring business confidence. The deficit is the devil, cry the new Hooverites, as they wildly slash spending and try to kill federal programs like Head Start that lift people up. Not to be outdone, a covey of extremist right-wing governors are demonizing, disempowering, and firing thousands of public employees. These little Hoovers maniacally shriek that with state revenues down and so many families out of work, the smart thing to do is to eliminate more jobs. They're shoving teachers, firefighters, and other public employees out the door, thus shutting off the taxes that these employees pay to the state while simultaneously increasing the number of out-of-work people looking for jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Hoovernomics is back, as goofy and destructive today as it was last century.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Woo-hoo! Yes, sir, we're selling it off. Selling everything off. Fire sale prices. You want a liquor store? We got it. Rock bottom prices. You want a turnpike? Yes, we can sell that too. You want parking garages? Get rid of it. We're going to privatize everything. Everything. Private police departments, private fire departments, private everything. Private military. I mean, we're almost doing that now. Privatize everything so that every month, when you go to your mailbox, there's a bill for the fire company, a bill for the mail, from the bill from the police department, a bill from the plow people, a bill from, you know, this people, a bill from here, a bill, and you're just writing checks all day long, and you're constantly reaching into your pocket. You know, I was having a conversation with my father-in-law who lives in South Carolina. He was telling me, you know, to go to this island to play golf. He goes, you know, to get to it, you gotta pay to park, you gotta pay to go on the ferry, you gotta pay to a transfer over there, you gotta pay to come back, you gotta pay to go on the road, you gotta pay. You're always reaching into your pocket. Always. And eventually we're gonna get into a situation where the average everyday working stiff, and that's who I care about. The Buffetts of the world, the top 5%ers, they are gonna be fine. The very wealthy, corporate executives, they're going to be fine. And even their underlings will be all right. I'm talking about the guy who goes to work and gets his hands dirty, about the person who goes to work, punches a clock, and if he misses a day, going to have a hard time making the rent. Those are the people I care about. We don't seem to have anybody in our government who cares about those folks. And if we do, we don't hear much from them. Because the loud megaphones, the big voices, are the ones who are bought and paid for, and for cheap. I look at this story from North Carolina. This is one of these things that just leaves me scratching my head. Stephen Webster writes, the Republican-dominated North Carolina State Assembly this week approved a bill that would prohibit communities from upgrading their internet access, forcing individual municipalities into private monopolies of managed broadband services by companies like Time Warner and Comcast. Both firms have been restricting the amount of bandwidth users can consume, even though, according to the article, bandwidth itself is not a tangible, meterable commodity. He goes on to say the bill, which was heavily supported by telecom giant Time Warner, comes on the heels of several communities successfully launching their own fiber optic broadband. So you got these communities who are saying, you know what? What we're getting from Time Warner, what we're getting from Comcast is not fast enough. It's pathetic. It's slow. And we're paying too much for it. Let's invest in our own. In top-of-the-line stuff, make our area, invest in our community, not only for us, but to draw people in. They point to one program in Wilson, North Carolina, called Greenlight. They have speeds up to 100 megabits per second at a lower price than Time Warner or Comcast. I pay through the nose for my Comcast. And he goes on to say that's because Greenlight is a public utility. The people of the area said, you know what? We'd like to have this. So instead of having this profit-making scheme, what you've got is you've got people who are taking the money that they're paying for their bill, reinvesting into that, making it a better service. Instead of focusing on the profit margins, instead of focusing on how we can stick it to people with user fees, they're figuring out how to make it a better internet, figuring out how to make it faster, more user-friendly. Now, the article goes on to say, prior to this green light, now this is where I agree with conservatives, this is where I agree with Republicans, and even, you know, here's the thing, it's a universal. Democrats agree with it too. Competition is good. It's good to have two people competing against each other, which is why big corporations don't want that, which is why they have legislatures pass laws like this one. He writes, prior to the arrival of Greenlight, most internet users in Wilson only had access to seven megabits per second and at a much higher price than the public utilities plan. Now, they're getting this big access, same price, you're getting 20 megabits now instead of 7 for the same price. If they wanted to upgrade to 100 megabits per second, it'd be about $150 a month. I think we're paying about $200 here for that, or half that. We're paying about $200 for half of that. Now, on Monday night, North Carolina's assembly voted 81-37 to bring it to a halt, banning other communities from upgrading. So what they're saying is what they've done is they've said, sorry, you're no longer going to be allowed to upgrade your public utilities. And I guess the only question I've got is, am I the only one who, of course I'm not. What am I talking about? You get this. This is corporations using government to stop themselves from investing in this stuff. This bill is going to ban other communities from upgrading their own connections and forcing them to get private providers. I mean, stop and think about that. It's amazing. Proponents of the broadband restrictions claim municipalities should not be able to borrow money to build networks without the explicit approval of the voters. That's why you vote for people who have vision and leadership. And that's why we have elections every couple of years. So that if they do this, get them out. But again, here's this concept, that core government function thing. And I'm telling you, I think investment in infrastructure, of which broadband is a core government function. And it's something that we should be looking at, not just in North Carolina, which I got to give them credit. I, to be honest, I didn't think they would do such a thing. But kudos to these five communities throughout North Carolina who had the vision and the foresight to say, you know what? We need better access. If we're going to attract business to our area, we need to have an infrastructure that encourages growth instead of relying on these monopolies. They also want the restrictions passed to prevent groups like Greenlight from providing services below what it costs, using money from other public utilities to cover the income gap. So we're protecting profit. Protecting profit. And it goes back to what I said at the beginning of the show. We have protected the investor class. We've protected the very wealthy. Again, and this is another example of this. This failure to invest, this failure to have a vision for the future. I point back to yesterday's story. We talked about the Reuters story that the United States fell to third place in the clean energy investment race, if you will. China came in first, Germany in second, according to a Pew Charitable Trust report. You know, they get it. The Chinese get it. Whoever's energy independent, whoever can produce their own energy wins. The Germans get it. They get that you need to have the ability to be independent of everybody else. You need to produce energy to keep your economy going. We're the only ones who seem to be not getting it. We get simple-minded sloganeers like, drill, baby, drill. And what exactly does that mean? We're drilling here in Pennsylvania all the time. Gas is leaving the state. We're not benefiting from it. Somebody is, not us. So anyway, today, Reuters reported the president gave a speech on energy. He proposed that we cut oil imports by a third over 10 years. Something that, you know, remember Jimmy Carter said he wanted to cut by 20%. Other people have wanted to cut. It's never happened. But, you know, it's a discussion worth having. The president said there are no quick fixes. We will keep on being a victim to shifts in the oil market until we finally get serious about a long-term policy for secure, affordable energy. It comes back down to this idea of a plan. What is this country going to look like in 25 years? No one really has a vision of that because we've bought into this idea of the invisible man, this idea of, you know, the invisible man will take care of it. The free market will come in and fill our needs. Well, what the free market has done is it's decided we're going to be hooked on oil. We're going to get stuck with the needle in our arm until the last drop is gone, and we are going to pay through the nose for it because that's how the system has been erected. Now, this is where government intervention has to happen. This is where smart policymakers, not campaign sloganeers, but actual smart policymakers, have to step forward and say, you know what? We need to move in the future. Tomorrow at 11:45 a.m., I'm going to be over at Hope Station in Carlisle. You know why? Because there's somebody running for county commissioner of Cumberland County who has a vision of what this county is going to look like in 25 years. And I got to be honest, the guy's got a great idea. If Florida doesn't want rail money, if Wisconsin doesn't want rail money, if these states want to turn this stuff down, why don't we have leaders in this area, leaders in this state who say, you know what, we'll take it. I've been talking about this Corridor 1 project since I got here over six years ago. There should be a rail line, a light rail line, whatever, going from Carlisle to Harrisburg, from Harrisburg to other communities that connect the region with the capital. And we should tie those in to getting to Philadelphia, into Pittsburgh, into Washington, into New York. It should all be there. But it's going to take vision. It's going to take leadership. So if you want to come out and stand with me tomorrow, 11:45 a.m. at Hope Station there in Carlisle, I think Mike Fedor has a great idea, and I think we need to support people who have good ideas, who think, who have visioned ideas, have a vision of what tomorrow looks like, not just worrying about, oh, gee, I just need to get elected. Oh, I just need to get past this next election. We need people who get it. And you look at energy policy for the last 30 years. These aren't people who got it. These are people who got campaign donations. These are people who were beholden to big oil. We had the vision. We did. Jimmy Carter laid it out. Solar energy banks, wind farms, all of the technology that we had then that everybody else took from us and moved forward. Well, now we're behind in the game. We're late to the game. Do we have the will? Do we have the vision to get off the juice? That's the question. And while we, you know, while we may not get as much oil from OPEC as we used to, while we may not use as much foreign oil as we're told, I got to be honest. I don't want to use any. When you're dependent on someone else, and you just stop and think about it from your personal life, when you're dependent on someone else for something, you got problems. Because they can jerk that away from you. They can pull that away from you at any time. And then what happens? Go back to our history. Look what happened in the early 70s when they turned off the spigots. This country stopped. And if we're not doing the smart things to get us off of oil, now it's never going to stop. We're going to always use oil. But do we need it to heat our homes? Probably not. We've got geothermal. We've got solar. Do we need it to run buildings? Probably not. We've got the technology. And this is where smart policy. Smart policy comes into play. People who are going to say, you know what, we're going to make building codes. 5 years down the road, we're going to give builders enough time, 5 years down the road, to make sure that every home built is energy independent. It's that simple. What do you think? Where do we go from here? What's the vision? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
I'll never turn. I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith, bringing sanity.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just applied for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you start to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference. Avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Yep, yep. Arrogance, ignorance, and greed. That kind of wraps it up. That's our CEO class. That's the they're the people who do their bidding. Like this Republican from Wisconsin, of all places, Representative Sean Duffy. Who was, he was at one of these meetings. Somebody asked him a couple of questions, asked him the question of about his salary. And, the first term conservative congressman who has been on, his biggest accomplishment is that he was a reality TV star on MTV's The Real World. So he asked this question. He opened his mouth, inserted his foot, saying he would cut his salary, but only as part of a plan to cut all public employee salaries. Kind of making it, I'll sacrifice with everybody else. And he's making $174,000 a year. Did I mention that? That's without his benefits. What he said that $174,000 that he gets a year is squeezing his family. There's seven people in his family, and here's exactly what he said. Quote, I can guarantee you, or most of you, I guarantee that I have more debt than all of you. With six kids, I still pay my student loans. I still pay my mortgage. I drive a used minivan. If you think I'm living high off the hog, I've got one paycheck. So I struggle to meet my bills right now. Would it be easier for me to get more paychecks? Maybe. But at this point, I'm not living high off the hog. His exact words. They want to pull the video clip of him saying that off the air. Polk County Republican Party there. They want to pull it off the air because that was kind of dumb of him to say. $174,000 a year, as one of the guys in the video said, that's three times what I make. And I'm still paying my mortgage, and I'm still paying my loans, and I drive a used minivan. To tell you just kind of how far out of touch they are. And look, I don't begrudge anybody making a couple of bucks. But $174,000 a year? Seems a bit high. Now, I'm not one of those people who are going to say, well, what we need to do is cut the legislature. No. I think we should increase access. I think we should have more people in Congress. I'd like to see some 700 in the House, up from 435. Do you know when they stopped increasing the size of the legislature, of the House? They kept the Senate, they can't increase. That's constitutional, 2%. That's how that's always going to be, never going to change. The House was supposed to be where the people had the raw passions of the people, where you and I went to have our voices heard and to raise a little, you know what, and to begin the process of changing things. The Senate was meant to slow things down. You know, say, whoa. You know, let's cool our heads. Let's calm it down a little bit, but still get things done. In the House, and you know, I was thinking about this today, as I was at the gym. They stopped increasing the size of the House of Representatives sometime around 1913. And I stopped and I thought about, well, what was going on at that time that would make them put the brakes on the growth of the House of Representatives? And I started to think the progressive era. We saw a whole bunch of progressive policies come out early in the 19th century, where people started getting things, where we started passing rules to protect workers, and we started passing rules to say, you know, maximum hour laws. We don't want people working 24/7. Passing child labor laws. There was all this movement towards social justice because you had access to these representatives. Because as the population grew, your representatives, the number of them grew. So you had continued to have access. And if I remember. And if you remember something differently, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. From my reading of the, you know, the beginning, it was supposed to be one representative for every 30,000 people. We're now well beyond that. It's into hundreds of one for every hundred, several hundred thousand. I think the number I saw was, you know, I forget what it is, to be honest, but it's a high number. You know, 70,000, 80,000, I think. It's got to be more than that. But if you, let me think. Hold on. Stop. Well, no, it got to be 700,000, over 700,000. Yeah. So you're talking about having an area where not everybody's going to get a chance to have their voice heard. So that's why I'm saying I think we need to open up and have more representation. So you would have more voices. Now you've got those who want to shrink it down. Like here in Pennsylvania, you got this Sam Smith who says, well, you know, gee, let's take it down to 153 from 203 in the House here. Let's shrink that down. Who benefits from having it shrunken down? It doesn't cost us that much to have the legislature. In fact, on the federal level, it costs about 19 cents a year If I remember it, out of every dollar that goes to Washington, it was 1.9 cents to run the Congress, which isn't an awful lot of money. But who benefits from shrinking it down? Who benefits from less access? Well, the people who want to control things, the corporations, the Koch brothers, the Scaifes, the big moneyed interests, because they have less people to lobby. Lower lobbyist costs, lower campaign donations. That's who wins in this. And I've yet to have anyone make a rational argument to me of why we should be cutting that, why we should be taking representation away. But I look at this Duffy guy, who just completely out of touch. His office released a statement saying that any Democratic criticism of what he said was a misleading attack. So I just read his quote. So that, evidently, it's a misleading attack on him, since I've read his quote. You take it for what you think it is. Talking Points Memo has written a report today that the White House has threatened to veto a major piece of legislation if its final version contains any anti-union provision that would make it harder for aviation and rail workers to organize. That measure, TPM points out, would undermine a fundamental principle of fairness in union representation elections, that outcomes should be determined by a majority of valid ballots cast, according to a statement of policy by the White House released today. The White House goes on to say, by treating non-votes as no votes, the provision would prohibit workers in the airline and railroad industries from voting whether to join a union on the same basis, majority rule, as most other industries. Now, what happens in the airline and rail industries, if those folks want to organize, there's a whole bunch of really twisted rules on how it goes about. But the biggest one is if you've got 10 people and 5 and 6 of them don't vote, and all 4 vote for it, you lose. Because those people who abstained are assumed to be people who voted against it. To me, that's misguided. If we ran our elections based on that, on the governmental, if we said, okay, well, let's pass a rule that every person in the country who doesn't vote wants to vote for a Democrat, I think the Democrats would sweep every year, and they wouldn't even need to get out their votes, because most of the people don't bother going to the polls and voting. So the no votes, or the non-voters, would be vote for Democrats. What kind of hue and cry do you think you'd hear from that? You would hear the right screaming like the right, always complaining about something. And I look at this and I say, you know, this is another one of those moments in our labor history, another of our labor law reform needs that isn't being addressed. And, you know, here's the thing. I've given Obama a little bit of credit here. He stood up and he said, we're going to veto this. It's not going to happen. And good for him. I still wish he would consider the Employee Free Choice Act again, get out in front of that. But given the House that we now have, that's never going to happen. And again, workers always seem to be second. A friend, Russ Feingold, has put out a letter asking for Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, to step down as President Obama's job czar. He says, you know, and the letter's interesting. He goes into the fact that GE made $14.2 billion in profit last year, paid zero taxes. They're the company who has shipped more jobs out of the country than anyone else. This guy, Immelt, has seen his compensation double over that period of time. Now they're asking for major concessions from their 15,000 unionized workers. And I'm telling you, they're dangling this out there that if you don't give us these concessions, we may have to move. You know, it's not like they're going to do it. Not like they're going to threaten to do it. Well, you know, we may have to. A nice veiled threat. But it's interesting. He has a website that I think people should go, imeltmustgo.com, to sign their petition to get the president to dump Jeffrey Immelt as their jobs are. Feingold writes, how can someone like Immelt be given the responsibility of heading a jobs creation task force when his company has been creating more jobs overseas while reducing its American workforce? And, you know, it's a question I've asked a thousand times. Why is this guy in charge of it? He's the outsourcer. Doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. But, you know, I guess that's just part of the movement to the right of middle by our president. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of healthcare and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Waiting the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Right now, as we speak, there are thousands of people in the Capitol in Albany, New York, protesting what the governor and the legislature trying to pass a $134 billion budget by Thursday's deadline. There are a bunch of people all those folks are coming to rally against the cuts. Cuts to primary education. Again, it cuts to state university. Cuts to job programs. Cuts, cuts, cuts. No talk of revenue increases. And I've been saying this for a while. I don't think we have a spending problem. What we have is a revenue problem. And New York especially. I mean, you're talking about the richest street in the world. If you cannot find some money to fund education on Wall Street, I'm sorry, Pennsylvania is going to have a real hard time doing it. Other states are going to have a real hard time doing it as well, because if you're not willing to tax those who have all of the wealth, and remember, the top 400 people in this country control half of the nation's wealth. 400 people control half of the wealth of the richest nation on the planet. Has that sunk in? 400 people. That's why we need to take to the streets. That's why, you know, and we're working right now to try and get a hold of somebody there to give us an update to see what's going on. But that's what's going to happen here in Pennsylvania. Those kids who were out here on Monday protesting, the kids we saw in Kutztown on Tuesday rallying, having their voices heard, they need to come here, bring their sleeping bags and say, you know what, Tom, we're not leaving. We're not leaving until we get our future back. And this is really, really a theft, an absolute theft of the future of these kids. You know, I remember going back to my going back to my years after high school. And to be honest, I grew up in a housing project in the west side of Cleveland, and I've said that a number of times. Some of the sadder things about that environment is I think it was up until I was 13 or 14 before I realized that college was a place that you went to get an education. And you may laugh, but growing up in that environment, the only people you ever saw going to college were athletes. In fact, you know, I just Googled the guy that I had remembered who got out of the projects, went off to the University of Dayton, went to Cleveland State, got drafted into the NBA. I think he had a cup of coffee in the NBA, but played in Europe and in Israel for numerous years. I found out he just passed away. But, you know, he was a guy who got out. Up until I was about 14, I thought college was that place where you went to play sports after high school. That's how you got out. These kids understand this opportunity, this educational opportunity, is going to be their ticket to the future. You know, I look at myself. You know, I went to college to play football, and I didn't do it very well. I ended up failing out. Car accident ended up really screwing me up, and you know, lost all of it. And it wasn't until I was 35 that I finished a bachelor's degree. After years of working on shipping docks and years of doing hard physical manual labor, you know, here I am in my mid-40s, two bad knees, a bum hip, and you know, a middle-class existence. You know, we live in a good neighborhood, roof over the heads, food on the table. But what would my life have been if I could have found the money to go to college when I was 19, 20, 21? Because we didn't have it. Sorry, I didn't have it. And I look at the kids and I say, you know what? I don't want you to end up in the same boat that I was in, where I worked 50, 60 hours a week to try and save enough money to go back to school. And then I would go back and then didn't have any money to survive. So it was either I had money and no time for school, or I had time and no money for school. And my future was doomed to hard physical manual labor that, you know, like it or not, is going to take years off your life. It's going to beat your body down. And there's nothing, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a good honest day's work. But in this economy, where we've taken away the reward of that kind of work, where now we say, you know, working in a warehouse is worth $10 an hour or $12 an hour, not enough to raise a family on. And we say that somehow sitting behind a desk and doing knowledge-based work is worth twice that much. There's an opportunity for these young kids to make their lives better. And I want that for everyone who's capable of doing it. And I look at the school down in Miami, who's offering a free associate's degree to anyone who has a B average through high school, can pass their entrance exam, and can do the work. That should be the litmus test in this. Not who can pay for it. And that's what we've come. And the more I see for-profit colleges popping up all over the place, these profit mills like, I can't even say, like University of Phoenix and Strayer and all these places where it's there's a big profit motive. And their CEOs are taking big multi-million dollar contracts at a time when they're taking huge amounts of money from the higher education funds. I think it was University of Phoenix got almost 90% of its money from the federal government through loans and guarantees. Is that right? It's money that's being taken away from the public's higher education institutes that need it. And the CEOs are skimming off a big portion of that. Is that the direction we want to go? Personally, I think, really, I believe that every person who can do the work should have the opportunity. Instead of what we're seeing here in Harrisburg, what we're seeing is this guy is going to keep his campaign pledge come hell or high water. And it doesn't matter who he hurts or what gets destroyed. He doesn't care what gets broken. But this belief that, oh, we're going to all be better off in the future, I'm not seeing it. Because here's the thing. In 20, 30 years, these kids that are going through college now and they're going through college in the next several years, Those are going to be the people who are taking care of me. Those are going to be the doctors of our future. Those are going to be the nurses of our future. Those are the people I'm depending on in my golden years. If we do not invest in them today, we are going to suffer in our my golden years anyway. And it's frustrating. I'm at a point where if I have to sacrifice a little bit today, and I don't mind seeing taxes raised a little bit, and I don't think most people do. If it means we're investing in the future, if it means we're investing in our state, infrastructure, education, broadband technology, public transportation, smart policy moves that are going to make this area more attractive for industry, make it more attractive for people who live here. I think most people, the silent majority, I think most people would sacrifice a little bit. I'm not talking about massive sacrifices. Look, I agree with the Tea Party people. I am taxed enough already. Every time I turn around, I'm reaching into my pocket to pay a fee or a tax of some sort. So I say, why aren't we going after the revenue that's out there? There's opportunity there. We're already paying the Marcellus Shale tax. Why aren't we going after it? It's one of those things, folks. And it comes down to priorities. What are our priorities? Where are we going from this point forward? And if our priority is underfunding education, if our priority is stealing the futures from these kids, that says an awful lot about us. Maybe the governor could use the money from the sale of the bus. Have you seen this? There's a bus up for sale. Commonwealth One. Evidently, the governor is kicking it to the curb. He claims that it costs $66,000 to maintain the bus. I really want to see those maintenance records. If it costs $66,000 to maintain that bus, I got to see it. Because that thing's got to be spick and span. It's got to be purring like a kitten. Because, in fact, if they spent that much on it, I may think about getting in on the auction. He claims that taxpayers paid almost $19 per mile for the bus. In 2009, it cost over almost $20 per mile. Last year, the bus cost $26 per mile, he says. So 2008, it was almost $19. It was $20 in 2009, $10. It was $26, his claim. He says they've spent over $1,300 on batteries and $550 to have it towed. So here's my problem. If you spend all this money on maintaining it, on maintenance, it shouldn't need to be towed. Anyway, it is going to be auctioned off. I'm sure they're going to try and put that money back into the coffers. Only got 26,000 miles on it during its 8-year lifespan. So hey, good. There might be a good deal. So check it out. I'd love to have it because I've heard people say it's very nice inside. Because if you remember, the governor ran across the state, all 67 counties, in the bus, doing the bus tour because that's popular. I remember when the Clintons did, when Clinton and Gore went across the country in the bus. And I said, did they really do that? And it turns out they actually did. Pretty amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to play a little song from a song a guy sent us that I think is fantastic. His name's Adrian Grimes. He's a Brit living in Madison, Wisconsin. We're going to talk about that when we get back.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America.
For the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Oral arguments were heard Tuesday in Dukes versus Walmart, the biggest sexual discrimination lawsuit in U.S. history,
A U.S. Supreme Court decision on the suit against Walmart is expected by early summer. The case is about whether women who work or worked for Walmart can come together as a class to sue over allegedly discriminatory pay and promotion practices. The workers say although women make up two-thirds of Walmart employees, just 14% of managers are women, and women at Walmart also make less money despite having higher average seniority. If the Supreme Court allows them to come together legally as a class, millions of workers could join the suit, and Walmart could potentially be forced to pay tens of billions of dollars. On Monday, April 4th, we are one as labor, faith groups, and community organizations nationwide stand together in solidarity to mark the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Jesse Russell has more.
April 4th, 1968. An assassin's bullet takes the life of Reverend Martin Luther King, who was in Memphis, Tennessee, to support black sanitary workers who had been striking since March 12th. The workers were demanding treatment equal to their white peers. On April 4th, 2011, labor organizations, workers, and the faith community plan to stand together in solidarity in cities across the United States. They are calling the one-day event, We Are One, to both honor King, but to also show unified strength in the face of legislation in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio that seeks to strip the right of workers to collectively bargain. Arlene Holt-Baker is Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO and a board member for Interfaith Worker Justice. On Tuesday, she explained the significance of the rally next Monday.
And today, just as in Memphis in 1968, nurses and teachers, students, firefighters, small business owners, and all working people are standing together. We honor Dr. King with our determination to stand up to this political overreach and ensure we build the future our children deserve.
The Autonomous Solidarity Organization, a new group of activists formed in the Madison pro-labor protests, is touring Wisconsin college campuses in an effort to get out the vote for the April 5th Wisconsin State Supreme Court race. Justice candidate Joanne Kloppenburg is backed by labor in Wisconsin, and this will be the first test of electoral power of the Wisconsin pro-labor movement sparked by the Republican attack on public worker collective bargaining rights. The group traveled with Jesse Jackson Monday and Tuesday for a series of campus rallies. Spokesman David Vines.
In the long term, our goal is to advocate for workers' rights, students' rights, the right to the middle class. We've had a tremendous trip so far. We've had a ton of positive response from the people that we've seen, the people that have been around us.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I get songs all the time from people who, from artists who say, you know, this is my song, you know, play it on the air, and this one just caught me, especially that line right there. If you can, as long as you can sleep with open eyes, it really frames it for me what Walker's doing in Wisconsin and Kasich and corporate here and the guy who steals candy from kids up in Maine. It just really puts it there for me. The guy who wrote this song, Adrian Grimes, is on the line. I got to tell you, buddy, great song.
Thanks very much. It's quite nice to hear a song of mine back on the radio after so long.
I get songs all the time, and most of them are these country songs that are, the government's bad, and you know, this used to be my country, and then the government stole it. It's good to hear something that talks about workers and that talks about actual movements.
Yeah, the song itself was written kind of in response to that kind of thing, but I didn't want to make it so obvious. I wanted it something that almost anyone could take hold of and effectively use for their own cause. And it's certainly when I read the lyrics back now, I kind of think how apropos it is to what Governor Walker is doing here, for example. And I kind of put something on YouTube. I think that there's so much nonsense flying around on both sides of the political divide at the moment that I felt I needed to point out that if you can sleep with open eyes, that's not really a violent threat. It's a metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
We will recall you.
Well, exactly. You're not safe on a nonviolent political plane.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm there with you. You know, you're originally from Britain, right?
Exactly, yes. You can tell from I'm not round from these parts or however it goes.
All right. Now you live in Madison, Wisconsin.
Exactly, yes.
You know, when you see the attacks that are going on against workers here, the conditions that some people work under here, how does that affect you being from across the pond, if you will?
Well, I mean, it obviously affects me directly. The peculiar thing is that I didn't come to Madison, Wisconsin until November of last year. I started a contract at the local university here, and I arrived here, being negotiated my contract, and the very first day I'm sitting in front of the lady from Human Resources, and she says, oh, of course you're going to have to take this number of furlough days a year. And I was going, what? And these furlough days had been negotiated some time ago, actually, I think under the previous governor. So it turned out that I was already being asked to make concessions as a worker in America under a contract that obviously I'd negotiated, and I didn't know anything about this. So it's affecting me directly, immediately. But I mean, it really is interesting to see how some of the policies of people like Governor Walker, and obviously this is happening in a lot of states now, they're really going after everyone in the public sector. And it's as someone has already pointed out, like going at this with an axe as opposed to with a scalpel. And it's indiscriminate and it's unfair.
Yeah, I agree.
It's unfair.
I say it's a chainsaw because an axe would be much more precise. they're going after it with a chainsaw instead of a scalpel.
Yeah, and a blunt one at that.
Exactly.
It's awful.
You know, but I look at what's going on in your home country there, and they're talking about the same kind of stuff. Massive cuts to education, social programs, just deep, drastic cuts. I'm saying that I don't know that we really have spending problems. I think we have revenue problems.
You're exactly right. It's revenue problems. And, you know, I don't want to get into the real deep stuff of it, but it's pretty clear why we have revenue problems. I mean, you just have to read any of the literature on the subject at the moment. And you can see that, you know, in this multi-trillion dollar economy of the United States, there are still a lot of people who are making, excuse the phrase, but a shit ton of money. You know, they're making an enormous amount of money, and yet the normal people are not. And I think Americans have to ask themselves a simple question. What do you want to pay for in your society? Do you want really crappy education systems? Do you not want people to plow your roads when it's snowing? You know, what do you want in a civilized society? And these are the questions that I think are being asked now. And I, for one, would rather support the guy that's going to take my garbage away than give money to a local business, because they might, in the future, employ someone.
Exactly.
I'd rather give the money to someone that's already gainfully employed and actually providing a service that I value.
Now, I'm right there with you. I wish more people thought that were willing to say that out loud. Look at our stat of the week, according to the Economic Policy Institute. The richest top 5% of the people in this country right now hold 63.5% of this nation's wealth. The richest country on the planet, you've got 5% of the people holding 63.5% of the wealth. The bottom 80%, people like me, just over 12%.
Yeah, no, it's outrageous. And, you know, I don't want to be rich. I don't. I mean, obviously it would be nice, but I don't care about whether I'm rich or not. I just want to be comfortable. Yep. And that's what most people want to be. They just want to be comfortable. They don't want to have to worry about whether or not they can afford to send their kids to school. And, you know, the sorts of things that are being suggested in Tennessee now, where they're talking about repealing child labor laws just so that you can make ends meet, is ridiculous.
And Missouri.
And Missouri, I didn't realize it was Missouri.
Yeah, Missouri has a really bizarre one, where, you know, if anyone 16 or older can work in a hotel as long as the hotel gives them rooms, they can be there as long as they want. And I'm going, really, 16-year-olds, hotel rooms, is that a good idea? Probably not.
Good Lord, no, that's just It's ludicrous.
But it's the kind of ignorance that we've got running our government right now. You know, being from Madison, we were there for a little over a week for the big rallies. Can you tell me what the feel is today? Are you still seeing a good number of people getting to the Capitol, or has the effort moved to the recalls?
The effort has undoubtedly moved to the recall, but the fascinating thing is that, you know, come rain or shine, there is always a presence. There are always people at the Capitol. I was there, in fact, just this weekend. The video that I gave you a link to, there's some footage of me sort of strumming a guitar by the Capitol Center. And there were probably a couple of 100-300 people just wandering around. So, every day there is someone carrying some sort of plaque around the Capitol Center. And then depending on, what other aspects of the movement are going on, you know, there might be, I think on Saturday morning, a whole bunch of professors walked about 30 miles from their university campus down to be at the Capitol. So, you know, that increased the presence to about 1,000 people. It's constant. It's ongoing. This is something that is just not going to go away.
Yeah, I sure hope not. What's your role at the university there?
I'm a researcher. I actually work on cardiovascular research. So, without going into too much detail, I'm trying to find out why it is that some kids fall dead on the basketball court, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow. That sounds to me like important research. The reason I ask is, you know, here in this state, we're talking about cutting 56% of the state funding for higher education. And it sounds to me what you're doing is pretty important work. And what I've been worrying about is if we're going to cut this kind of money from higher education, who's going to do the research that you're doing? Who's going to be the generation that takes care of me? I'm in my early 40s when I get to be older.
Well, actually, it's a really interesting question. And in fact, I was reading on actually the BBC World Service just 2 days ago that China now is overtaking America in terms of research. And again, this is another question that you guys as Americans have to ask yourself. When you sort of go around and you take full advantage of all of the technological breakthroughs that have happened in the Industrial Revolution or since the Industrial Revolution, do you want those to all be made in Taiwan and China based on inventions that occurred there, or would you prefer them to be American? I for one, would prefer it if it was coming from America. But it's another one of my soapbox issues, if you like, is that almost immediately a government gets into financial straits, the first thing they cut is Scientology and education. It's an easy target. It really is.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing here. And not just here in Pennsylvania, but really all across the country where Republican governors and even some Democratic governors, like in New York, right now there are people in their capital, taking over their capital. And a little bit later on the program, we're going to talk to somebody from Albany, New York about what's going on there. Adrian, I love this song. You mind if we play it, on into the coming days and months and years?
Oh, feel free, absolutely, and I won't even tap you for royalties. No, I mean, that was the whole point. Get the thing out there and get it played, and you know, it would do me a huge favor and a huge honor if you would put a link to it on your website and stuff like that. But, yeah, let's get this message out there. The more of this sort of thing that happens, because it really is grassroots. I mean, it's people like me, it's people like you. It's people that are just objecting to this. And the more we get the word out there, the stronger it will become and the better it will be for everyone.
Well, I got to tell you, Adrian, while I love the song and I think it's great and I'd love to have everybody hear it, I think what you're doing in research is far more important, and I would love to have your name as the one who figured that out and made sure it doesn't happen anymore.
Oh, bless you, sir. And actually, I should, before I finish, I should point out that you and I have something in common. When I was doing my master's degree, I was driving trucks around for a living. So I gather you came up the same route.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, hold on, you drove in Britain?
In Britain, yeah. While I was actually working on my master's degree, I used to drive trucks for a supermarket, you know, like Giant or, you know, Harris Teeter or whoever it happens to be. So I would pick up a truckload of groceries from a big depot. And then I would take that to the supermarket, and while I was being either loaded up or unloaded, I'd be sitting in the cab with my laptop working on my thesis.
Yep, I remember those days. Adrian, I appreciate the time, and I'm glad you are where you are. Keep up the great work on all fronts, and thanks for the song.
Well, thanks very much for having me on your show.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Took him some 80 years, but he has now made what looks to be a full comeback to power. He is Herbert Hoover. With the Great Depression spreading misery across America, President Hoover's prescription was to insist on reducing the size and spending of governments in order to boost business confidence. Hoovernomics was a disaster for our country, and it was not good for him. He lost the presidency in 1932 to FDR. So here we are in a new century with widespread, relentless unemployment, mass underemployment, stagnant wages, a rapidly falling middle class, and dimming economic prospects even for college-educated young Americans. In the face of this destabilizing, inegalitarian pressure on our economy and society, what remedy are America's corporate and political leaders demanding? Hoovernomics. Not a single jobs bill is in the congressional hopper. Despite rhetoric about a new green economy, the White House has offered no job creation plans at all. Instead, Washington's entire energy is going down the Hoover hole of restoring business confidence. The deficit, the devil, cry the new Hooverites, as they wildly slash spending and try to kill federal programs like Head Start that lift people up. Not to be outdone, a covey of extremist right-wing governors are demonizing, disempowering, and firing thousands of public employees. These little Hoovers maniacally shriek that with state revenues down and so many families out of work, the smart thing to do is to eliminate more jobs. They're shoving teachers, firefighters, and other public employees out the door, thus shutting off the taxes that these employees pay to the state while simultaneously increasing the number of out-of-work people looking for jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Hoovernomics is back, as goofy and destructive today as it was last century.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
I've been saying it from the beginning. The whole reason we went to Wisconsin back during the height of that was not only to be part of history, but to bring back the idea of what we're going to have to do here in Pennsylvania when the attacks start. And across the country, people are going to have to take to their state houses and have their elected officials hear their voices. Let's go to Albany, New York. I've got Jessica Wisniewski on the line. She's the legislative campaign director for Citizen Action of New York. Jessica, what's going on in Albany tonight?
So tonight there are still hundreds of people in the Capitol, probably about 450 students, activists, parents, children, whose education funding is being cut by the billions of dollars, community members fighting for all kinds of social programs, and all demanding that the tax on millionaires that is currently on the books in New York stay on the books in New York to generate the revenue needed to really close up the budget gap that they say exists.
Yeah, I've been saying all along that I don't believe we have a big spending problem. I believe we have a revenue problem. And if we can't raise revenue in a place like New York that has the wealthiest street in the country, the rest of us have got problems.
Yeah, Governor Andrew Cuomo has chosen to give tax breaks to millionaires and cut billions of dollars from the state budget, mostly in health care and education funding. And it's, you know, we're expecting between 15 and 18,000 teacher layoffs alone. And so it's a direct assault on working people, on middle class people. And we're here to make our voices heard. The Senate and Assembly are currently in session voting on this awful budget. And we are out here making our voices heard for sure outside the Senate and Assembly chambers.
Yeah, we can hear the folks in the background. Give me a little background on New York, because I've got to be honest, I'm not up on the numbers there. Who controls the legislature? I know the governor is a Democrat. Who controls your legislature?
I put the Democrat in quotes. So Governor Andrew Cuomo is a Democrat officially, and the Senate is back in the hands of the Republican majority. We had a 2 years worth of Democrats in control, but they lost the election in November. So the Republicans are in the Senate majority. We have Assembly Democrats in the vast majority over in the Assembly of New York State.
So, you know, again, this takes me back to this whole thing that, you know, that sometimes that whole Democrat Republican thing doesn't play out. These are corporatists who are willing to give out tax breaks to corporations off the backs of those who can least afford it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a whole other campaign we're fighting here beyond making sure that the most rich pay their fair share is for voter-owned elections or public financing of elections. So we can start, you know, actually having some competition and getting folks from the community running for office and really speaking for the people and voting for the people. So, you know, campaign after campaign, this is the beginning of the next level of the campaign. We have until the end of December to extend the personal income tax surcharges that were passed in 2009 that upped the tax income brackets here in New York on folks who make over $200,000 and over $500,000. That's $4 billion worth of revenue the governor is throwing back to the rich. In exchange, he is cutting all kinds of social programs. So the hundreds of people here tonight are angry, and we will not stop. And we plan on staying the night in the state capitol, whether they like it or not.
That's exactly what I've been telling people here. You know, we had a rally here. More than 1,000 college students from across the state came to the capitol here in Harrisburg. And I said, the next time you come, bring your sleeping bag. Could make this camp capitol, because that's the only way I think things get done. Make them drag you out of the capitol.
Well, we're hoping they won't have to drag us out. You know, we do believe this is our building, and we plan to stay here as long as possible. And we're going to do our best to do that and make our point.
So explain to me if you would, what kind of cuts are they talking about, number-wise? Like with education, what are we talking about there?
So the governor's budget proposed $1.5 billion in cuts to public education in New York State. And right now the Assembly only put back in their version of the budget bill about $250 million in restoration. So these are severe teacher layoffs, cuts to important programs all across the state, and hitting the most vulnerable schools. There are schools on Long Island in the richest part of our communities that have horseback riding for gym class here.
Wow.
And, of course, we have, you know, schools in inner city Syracuse and Rochester and the Bronx that are facing massive layoffs and using books that are outdated, huge class sizes. So the difference between one town and you go over another in another town, the schools are completely inequitable. And that's for years of funding through politics and, you know, Republicans taking an unfair share of the education funding to begin with. So we're trying to reverse that, and clearly the battle will continue. I think we've done a tremendous job in the last 3 months of changing the public debate here. But Governor Cuomo is a very popular governor, and I think people are just being fooled. And we are starting to change the story, remind people of what these cuts really mean to them and their communities.
Yeah, because it means you know, we're going to have less people to take care of me when I get to be older, less doctors, less professionals, less tax revenue in the future.
Absolutely.
That's just how I see it. Jessica, I appreciate your time. I hope things are going there. How long do you plan on staying there? Is there a plan, or is this just happening?
So, you know, this is the first time we've had a day like this where everything was not planned out. So things are going pretty well. We're allowed to be in the building as long as the legislature is in session. They're known to go to, you know, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning on these last days of the budget. Our budget is finally due on April 1st, and they're pretty dedicated to passing it through before then. So I imagine they'll be here quite late tonight, and we'll be here too. Supposedly the building shuts down an hour after session is over. we're going to stay, and we're going to see how it goes and make decisions as a group as things come. We've got some backup plans, but our goal is to stay here throughout the night.
I'd love to hear what happens tomorrow if you've got time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jessica.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Jessica Wisniewski, a legislative and campaign director of Citizen Action New York. Again, you know, we go back to this, and you know, that energy that was in Wisconsin, that energy that we've seen in state houses across the country, the energy that was here in Harrisburg when more than 1,000 college students came and had their rally, that's the kind of stuff that I think changes public opinion. That's the kind of stuff that we absolutely need in moving forward. Really, honestly and truthfully, it's going to take people rising up. It's going to take people taking into the streets. You remember when the Tea Party people started coming out in the streets? I got to be honest, I was kind of with them. I was like, hey, I'm angry too. Let's change things. And then they took that bizarre turn that we want government to run like businesses. And I said, really, is that the way we want to go? Because that's what's making things worse. That's how this stuff gets crazy. So, just amazing stuff. Let's go to the phone line. I got Helen on line too. How are we doing tonight, Helen?
Hi, I'm fine. You know, talk about these cuts. Over the weekend, I listened to this Dr. Lewis Shepherd. She wrote a book, If That Ever Happens to Me, talking about, you know, if you were in the situation like Terri Schiavo.
Right.
And the number of people that are in some kind of semi vegetative state,
right,
is like tens of thousands, she said.
Really?
And the interviewer asked her, are you sure? And she said, yes. So if they cut all these people, the caretakers, what's going to happen to all of these people? And, you know, this is the pro-lifers are cutting the money to take care of them.
Well, you see, like I've been saying, you know, the reality is during the campaign, it sounded great. We're going to cut spending. We're going to cut government. Everything's going to be small, and you're going to have freedom. And the freedom, obviously, as you're pointing out, is the freedom for those folks to die.
Yeah, I mean, they keep saying that there's the death panels that Mr. Obama had, but it seems like the death panels are with them cutting the numbers of people that will be taking care of the people in ill health.
And not only that, I mean, you know, you want to talk about death sentences. What about these kids that aren't going to have an education and they've got limited opportunity in the future? And years of their lives are going to be lost because, you know, now they're struggling doing hard, heavy manual labor jobs into their 50s, 60s, 70s. What about that? We're not even having that discussion.
If they can find those manual labor jobs.
Point taken.
They'll be out cutting wood and trying to find somebody to buy it from them. Right. I've got relatives that do that. They go out in the woods because in Pennsylvania you can cut, you know, some certain parts of the forest that need cutting. And then you've got to find somebody that'll buy it from you. And they don't have actual jobs. They're just managing to get by
as best
they can.
Yeah, they're existing. And that's what I fear.
Exactly.
I fear we're going to turn into a society that is just existing while we have, you know, like I said, 400 people control half of the wealth in the richest country in the world. 400 people. It's mind-blowing, Helen. And then we're talking about stealing an education from kids. Nuts.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, again, it's just nuts when you look at the distribution of wealth. And whenever, you're talking about redistribution of wealth, you're damn right I am. The same redistribution of wealth that happened that took it out of our pockets and put it into theirs. You know, when Reagan took office, we had like 3 billionaires in the country. That was it. 3. Now we've got what? 1,200? You don't think that's a redistribution of wealth from you and me to them? You better wake up, smell the coffee. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a break right back after this.
Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make
your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living, rich and farmer. Father sure left a cameo, blew down, had his vein. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally and occasionally use it here on the program. If you missed any portion of the show, TheRickSmithShow.com, you could download the podcast there for your convenience, entertainment, enjoyment, and I'd love to hear what you've got to say. Our quote of the day comes from economist David K. Johnston, who I just think is brilliant. He says, how is it that big publicly owned electric utilities like the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power manage to hire competent managers in the mid six figures, while corporate owned utilities pay in the millions and sometimes, and in some cases, in the millions per month? And, you know, I've asked that question. You know, we keep talking about, especially on Wall Street, when we were talking about capping salaries on Wall Street at like $500,000 a year. And I kept saying, well, you can't get qualified people for $500,000 a year? Really? Yet we're talking about stealing wages from public sector workers. And I go back to the story of the guy I met in Madison, Wisconsin when I went to have my oil changed. I'm not sure if he owned the place that changed my, I think he was the owner. But he was talking about the guy who was in front of me, who had just left, had some service done. He was retiring from the state. He was retiring from his job working for the state, and he was going to do the exact same job for a private contractor, making twice the money. And this guy was upset. That, and you'll love this, he was upset that this guy was, the other guy was going to be able to retire, take his pension, and still do the job that he was doing, making twice the money. He wasn't upset about the fact that the job cost twice the amount of money. Which again, you know, I go back to this whole disconnect. For me, when the guy told me the story, I was angry. I'm going, really? We've privatized the job that's now costing us twice as much as it would have cost to have a career 20-some-year guy who was very competent in his duties doing it for us? And I think, you know, I think maybe when I left, he was thinking a little differently. At least I hope he was. But when I look at the statement like David K. Johnston's, why is it that public utilities can find competent, decent people? Mid-six figures. You know, I'm not against people making a good living. But yet, when we look at the big privately owned, you know, the big for-profit companies, the corporate-owned utilities, they're in the millions. I mean, the reality is you know, it's this disconnect. And we have this big gap between those who have and those of us who are struggling, who are surviving, who are existing. And you look at the new house stats, because the new housing stats are out now, and they show this widening, this big gulf between us and them. The Census Bureau reported last week, and I think we talked about this, that the builders in this country only sold 19,000 new homes in February. That is officially the lowest number of new homes sold since the Census Bureau started keeping records of home sales back in 63. Now, vacation home sales for the very well-to-do, thank you very much, in prime locations like Cape Cod have skyrocketed. In places like Palm Beach, soared 40%. Sales everywhere in the luxury sector, in the luxury home sector, going up. The wealthy are doing very well. Global luxury spending, after dropping 8% in 2009, has jumped by 15% in 2010, according to researchers at Bain & Company. So the wealthy have $300,000 to spend on jewel-encrusted silver cutlery. A knife. $300,000 on a set of knives. Really? $100,000 on matching champagne flutes. Glasses. $100,000 for a pair of glasses. A purse. My wife doesn't carry a purse, but if she came home and said, honey, I want this $3.8 million purse. I'm sorry, they call it handbags. It's a purse. You and I, we're not in that area. You and I can't afford this, but we're paying for it. We're paying for it by not going after the revenue that's out there. And you look at the Wall Street Journal report today. There's a Russian investor who just bought a French chateau-style mansion in Silicon Valley. You know how much he spent for a house in Silicon Valley? $100 million. The highest known price paid for a single home, family home in this country. You don't think that kind of bears out the difference between us and them? This isn't just any little shack. This isn't the 2,500 square foot house that I live in, paid $160,000 for. This is a 25,000 square foot mansion. His name's Yuri Milner. He's the head of Digital Sky Technologies. He purchased a $100 million mansion. And I love this. According to the story, a spokesman for Yuri says Yuri has no immediate plans to move into the house. So he paid $100 million for a house. He's not moving in. Explain that to me. If I owned a 25,000 square foot house, I think I would go. I think I would live there. Anyway, according to the National Association of Realtors, and their sales of homes over $1 million rose by 4% in February over last year. Compare that to the nearly 8% decline in sales for homes that you and I would buy, somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000. Now remember, also today on the oceanfront down in Palm Beach, $26.4 million oceanfront condo home was sold. So they're doing all right. They're doing just fine. And, you know, you look at the home buying, because this, our economy is based on people buying homes. It's based on people furnishing homes. It's based on that upward mobility of first-time home buyers going from an apartment into a house and going, you know what, we need stuff to fill our house. You know, I look at my house, and we had a fire back in 2001 where we lost everything. We had nothing. And I look at my house now, and I go, honey, what have we done? because I have no room in my house because we've filled it with junk. That's what happens when people buy a house for the first time. They move from their little apartment where they used to be able to move by sticking their stuff in the back of their car. Now they need a 53-foot trailer. That's how the economy works. And what's going on is we've seen first-time homebuyers just crushed by this. In fact, according to the USA Today piece, on Monday, many first-time homebuyers are sitting on the sidelines of the housing market, hampering the ability to gain traction. Last month, 34% of existing home purchases were made by first-time homebuyers. 34%. What they're saying is a healthy market. That would be 45%. So we're really struggling, and they're saying that there's some reasons. The expiring tax credits that were out there, because you remember they had about $8,000 that they were given to first-time homebuyers to buy a new place to try and pump up the housing market. They're also claiming that there are tightened lending standards, which I'm in favor of, and they're saying that competition has really kind of hampered things a little bit. I'm not quite sure how. He said in February, cash buyers accounted for a record 33% of existing home sales. In some areas, including Southern Nevada, cash buyers now account for more than half of existing home sales. Sellers often prefer cash because they're more likely to close because there's not money. I get it now. They're having a hard time getting loans. Now, understanding the fact that we have an economy that's built on people buying new homes. We've had the least amount of new homes sold in the history of the record keeping anyway. We're not seeing, you know, the movement that we would see of people buying second homes, moving up from their first to their second. There's a bunch of numbers on that. But what we are seeing is we're seeing profits rising to the top. And you look at the numbers, the stuff that I just told you about the home buyers, about, you know, the fact that 19,000 new homes were sold. And you look at what the Wall Street Journal has called one of the fattest executive compensation pays of last year. He was a guy who was a CEO of a home building company. The company's NVR Incorporated, and our big CEO, Paul Saville, he's the CEO there of NVR. His compensation for 2010, now understand, housing's in the toilet. We're not building record amounts of homes. We're not doing all of that stuff. It's stagnant at best, and I would say dropping. He took $31 million in compensation. $31 million. Understand, he also took $21.7 million in exercising his stock options. So you're looking at $52.7 million in an industry that is tanking. I mean, they're trying to bring it up, but $52.7 million? Really? I often wonder what his workers are paid. Across the rest of the industry, the CEOs of other companies like Stuart Miller of Lennar, he took $9.7 million in compensation. Era Havarnin, he took $6.3 million. Jeffrey Metzger, $6.1 million. The other guys, $5.6 million and $4.1 million. So not even in the ballpark. But again, it's all about the CEO. It's all about rewarding those at the very top. Now, for me, I'd say, you know what? He's probably worth about $500,000 a year. Take that other $21.2 million in stock options, that other $30.5 million, and pay your workers better. See, that's what a union would do. They would say, you know what? You know what, Mr. Chief Executive? You took $31 million. Company must be doing real well. Let's share some of that. That's what happens. If we had stronger voices on the job, if we had stronger people at the table, and I've said this before, if you're not sitting at the table, you're on the menu. And how many people get to sit at the table? Well, 400 people own half of the wealth in this country. Think of that. The wealthiest nation on the planet. 400 people. And this guy taking $31 million isn't one of them. Stop and think of that for a little bit. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. Back after this. I see them blue.
it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to drill. Which side are you on? Which side?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. I would love to hear from people. I do enjoy the email back and forth, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Or you can just go to our site and click on contact. Here's the thing. You got to give an A for ingenuity. I saw this Reuters story out of Philadelphia. It just kind of made me go, well, you got to give them credit. Three inmates and their loved ones were charged with attempting to smuggle drugs into a New Jersey jail. Not, you know, how you would think, you know, not, you know, hidden in certain orifices or not, you know, in books or, well, wait a minute. Yeah, it wasn't a book. They put it in children's coloring books. Evidently, the drug Subozone, normally used to treat heroin addicts, but is classified a controlled dangerous substance, was discovered in these books. It was dissolved into a paste, and then they painted it into the coloring book, according to Cape May County Sheriff Gary Schaefer. Pages with "To Daddy" scribbled on the top were sent to the prisoners at the jail. There, he says, "I've been in law enforcement 38 years and never seen anything like this." amazing. You got to give an A for creativity. A group of about 70 protesters who were arrested in 2005 during the inauguration of George W. Bush, they're going to receive about $2,000 each, according to a settlement in a Washington federal court. The police arrested demonstrators and claiming they were vandalizing the D.C. area. Turns out, wasn't the thing. They claimed that, you know, they were just thugs and hoodlums and troublemakers. Kind of what they were saying about the people in Wisconsin. As we were driving out, you know, the reports that we were, you know, getting vaguely were, you know, there's a lot of union thugs there. It's chaos. You know, there are riots. And when we got there, I met people like my neighbors who, hey, would you like a cookie? Bratwurst? I gotta be honest, love the bratwurst. Probably not good for me, probably not good for my diet, but excellent, excellent stuff. Thank you to the building trades people out there in Wisconsin. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's what they do though. And this is why you need to have people overseeing this. And again, I go back to this idea. If you remember the phony phone call with Governor Walker, who said, the fake Koch brothers said, hey, you know, what about sending in some troublemakers? And Walker said, well, you know, we thought about that. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it at all. And I don't doubt if they thought that they could get away with it, they would. Interesting quote from Michael Moore today. He says, because of the horrific violations of our American values and of human values, he said, we need the United States, and especially our military, needs to go to a timeout room. He said he told that to Roseanne Barr during an interview on Headline News. He said, we really shouldn't be dropping bombs or invading anybody else for some time to come. And I got to be honest, I am not in favor of doing what they're doing. The president made a very good argument for getting involved. I do believe that's what the international community is for. It's not for us. Send some, you know, we chip in. Hey, we'll be an equal partner. If everybody chips in, all 100 and whatever the UN is, fine. Here's some money. Here's a little bit of resource. You guys take care of it. That's what the international community is for. And I agree with Dennis Kucinich, who gave an impassioned speech on the floor of the House, who said, look, we're talking about spending $113 billion this year in Afghanistan. We're talking about spending several hundred million dollars, sending, you know, things over to bombing Libya. Shouldn't we be talking about educating our children? Shouldn't we talk about getting health care for our citizens? $113 billion. We're talking about spending in war, in treatment, in all of the things surrounding Iraq and Afghanistan. I've seen numbers as high as $3 trillion. $3 trillion. And when you go, I'm sorry, we can't afford education for the kids going to college. We can't afford longer kindergarten days. Oh, sorry, we have to put 40 or 50 or 70 kids into a classroom because, you know, we can't afford it. The money's not there. Or sorry, Mr. Worker, guy who's been working a manual labor job all your life. Sorry, 65 is just too young. You're going to have to take those 65-year-old bones that are beaten and battered and broken and work a couple more years. You know, Walmart needs a greeter. And now you look in Maine. And again, this, oh, man, you know, you look at this guy in Maine, this LePage, who admitted, you know, when I was a kid, yeah, I used to lay in wait for the kids to come by with their bags of candy, and I'd beat them up and take their candy. That's the guy you got running your state. They've got a bill going through their legislature. That's LD 1346 it is, that would establish a training wage for students under 20 years old at $5.25 an hour for their first 180 days of employment and increase the amount of hours that minors can work. So it's not that we have, it's not that it's bad enough. We got 14.5 million people unemployed. That's not bad enough. It's not bad enough. We've got some 4.5 million people who have been out of work more than 99 weeks. That's not bad enough. We need to dilute the labor pool even more by introducing cheaper labor and younger labor. Because we need to pull all of the wages down even further. And, you know, you go across the country. There are states across this country who are, they're just dying to go back to the good old days of the late 1800s where we had children working in mines. I don't get it. Where are the sane, rational people? Look, Republicans, I'm sure there are a couple of you left that have half a brain. At some point, you got to look at your party and say, folks, you've gone too far. Because they've always had crazies in each party. There's crazies in the Democratic Party. That the party says sometimes, you know, say, hey, sit down. Relax. Well, you know what? If you're a Republican, go to your party meetings. Tell your people, relax, sit down. You're getting crazy. This idea of putting kids into the workforce. Extending school night hours to 11 o'clock at night just seems dumb to me. Is this what we fought for? We fought generations for? So that our kids could have opportunities that my grandparents didn't have? And now we're going to take it away for what? For what? Who benefits from this? Well, you know who benefits from it? The people at the very top. Those 400 who own half of the wealth in this country. That's who benefits. And I think Kucinich is spot on. Let's take care of our land. And I agree with him. The president should have came to Congress first. That's what the Constitution's for. I'm with the teabaggers. Whoever's going to stand up for this, I'm with them. Because it's right. And I wish more people look at what's right instead of what is political. You know, what my side's looking for. My team's winning. My team's in charge. It's just plain nuts. Anyway, Jim Brady. You remember Jim Brady? The guy who got shot when the guy who was after Jodie Foster, which really, Jodie Foster? You couldn't think of anybody better than that? Anyway, he was Reagan's former press secretary. On Wednesday, it marked the 30th anniversary of the presidential assassination attempt that left him in a wheelchair. He urged Congress to toughen gun laws. For 13 years after the shooting, Brady and his wife, Sarah, they've advocated for tightening gun laws so that things like this don't happen, so crazy people don't get guns. Maybe have a little bit of a litmus test. And yeah, I've had this conversation a number of times. To me, the Constitution is an organic document. It does grow with the times. But I think originally it was for people who were in the military, because we were all supposed to be part of the militia. But I do think there has to be some rationality. Unlike what's going on in South Carolina. A law proposed down in South Carolina, it's making its way through the legislature there, is going to loosen gun ownership really to an amazing level. If it's passed, gun owners can bring their guns to the restaurants, daycare centers, and even churches. So, like that church down, I think it was Virginia, bring your gun to church day. their idea is it puts the criminals on defense. Here's my problem. And, you know, maybe bring your gun to church day isn't a bad idea if you go to a liberal church, because it's the right-wing gun nuts who are shooting people in church. At least that's how I remember it. So, again, you know, I don't know that I want, I don't know, it's just one of those things. I don't want people with guns at daycare centers, especially some of the Lulus that I've known. But one good thing, if you did have guns in restaurants, maybe the Robert Blake defense would work more often. Anybody remember Beretta? He actually won on this defense. I didn't kill my wife in the parking lot because I left my gun on the seat in the restaurant, and I went back for it. Somebody bought it. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests. We're going to keep up on what's going on in New York. I think it's exciting when people get into their capital and take over their house. I'm hoping that happens here. I'm hoping that we see who our friends are and who aren't. But we're going to keep up on that. Hopefully tomorrow we'll have more information on it. Thank you for being here. I want to thank Brett, our executive board op, our executive producer, the guy who slides the tubes and rods the knobs and all that. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Attention working people of America, it's Mr. Picket Man, and I'm back better than ever. It's time to